Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 439 of the Roguecast, recorded November 7th, 2023. The game remains the same. Hello and welcome to the most momentous Roguecast ever produced.
Randy, you are your checks. Your mouth is cashing checks. Your butt. Your mouth is writing checks.
What expression were you saying?
Man, I don't use this phrase that often.
My butt is checking cash.
Who writes checks anyway?
It's an old expression.
Yes,
you guys are writing PayPal.
Yes, my mouth is writing checks. My butt can't cash.
Yep. So, but in what way will it be momentous?
Because we got a big announcement.
Oh, yeah.
About the store.
It is. I mean, it's moderately big.
I believe it's your idea, sir.
This is a more of a streamlining cool thing, though. But yes, I guess the gist of it is this. To briefly backtrack, in the pandemic, we gained the ability to sell DC books on Tuesdays.
Yep.
Which seemed cool, but like was never like a really big thing. And like a lot of shops don't do it. They just consolidate it all on one day. Mm-hmm. And that did prove to like be a thing that we're like, oh, you know, that would help us in some ways. It would mean that everybody gets a shot at the books at the same time. It would mean that the wall is a little bit cleaner and it's like kind of strictly alphabetical and not like Marvel here, DC here kind of thing. And
believe me, if you're here every week for what multiple years, like 3 years now, more years than that, having to tell people on those Tuesdays, like, oh yeah, no. The DC comics come out on Tuesdays. Everything else comes out on Wednesdays.
Right.
It becomes very... It seems needlessly confusing.
Yes. Right. And it's becoming even more so because they... other books are, like... certain things look like they might be available on Tuesday.
Well, yeah. Some graphic novels that are put out by Penguin but aren't put out by Diamond are...
They're street dated for Tuesday because bookstores do Tuesday
nights.
Isn't that kind of thing.
And so we're like... Let's go ahead and consolidate and make Wednesday the big day, as it all long time has in comic shops.
Rebranded as New Comics Day.
Yes, it's always been, but now it's the real New Comics Day.
It's not like we don't carry books. We are a bookstore, but we're a comic book store.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
And that means that we don't do Tuesday releases. We do Wednesday releases. Yep. Wednesday is New Comics Day and has been for 30 years, longer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, yes, we are going back to Wednesday. So when you come in on a Wednesday... There will be a glorious wall of all of the comics alphabetically together.
Yep.
You won't have to figure out what was what. You won't come in and discover that someone bought the last copy of Superman yesterday because it was on sale on Tuesday.
Yep.
Right. The only people who have to adjust is people who have been coming in for DC only on Tuesday. And we're sorry about that, but there's not... I don't think there's that many of you, and I think you probably will be good with just coming in on one day, whether it's Wednesday or Tuesday.
Yeah. I think so.
I think it's going to be cool for people, and I think it'll make kind of like Wednesdays in some ways feel like... Like that classic comic Wednesday.
It'll make Wednesdays great again.
Yeah. Whoa.
That phrase is forever ruined.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for ruining the word great, asshole.
All right, so that big announcement out of the way, and that will start next week. The podcast will remain as the same.
Yep. Right. Everything, it was momentous before, now the podcast is going to kind of
The podcast remains the same.
Man. You know what? Since you mentioned
that... Do you have to explain it?
That is a reference that I think people should...
Oh, by all means.
We've talked about it before, but when D&D 4th edition came out, I know, most people didn't like 4th edition. It doesn't matter for the purposes of this story. They did a hilarious and I think kind of awesome little lead-in that was a video with, for some reason, a French guy.
A weird French guy.
Talking about the history of D&D and, you know, like in a sort of tongue-in-cheek, like, minute or two little video showing people awkwardly fumbling around at the table as they, like, tried, and, like, somebody would be like, I want to grapple. And they all, like, oh, no. And every player, like, takes out their book to look up the grappling rules. And then they show, like, that's first edition. And then they show quick little snippets of what it was like playing second and then third edition. And, like, and it would always go back to, like, I want to try and grapple them. And then everybody's like, oh, no. And, you know, their whole notion was 4 would be the most streamlined edition. this is an entertaining little video that you want to look up if you can. The guy's recurring refrain is he's like, "The game remains the same," and he repeats it like that. That the heart of D&D is there, but they have made it better.
It was so effective, Dave, that you and I still remember it. However many years
later. Yes, we'll always still go back to the game remains the same.
So anyway, have you searched for, I don't know, how do you find this video?
I would say D&D 4th edition game remains the same. Ad. Okay. Yep. That would almost certainly turn it up.
Or if you throw in French. Frenchman.
Maybe. but yeah, it's a bit of weirdness. But you know, it was D&D that taking itself both somewhat seriously, but also putting out a kind of clever video.
Yeah.
And you know, until like now, we're kind of used to like Matt Mercer era and like people being kind of clever about D&D. But it used to be they were just like, join in the adventure. You know, it was just real straightforward. Yeah. And this was getting a little bit of sly wit into the D&D stuff. And they could make fun of themselves a little bit for some of their awkward rules, so.
It's maybe a challenge.
Oh,
did that search, it did not turn up. So, yeah.
All right.
If you find it, make sure and
send it to us, please.
Yeah. Russell, email us and tell us how you
found it. Let us know that you found it. send it to us.
Yep. Okay. New games this week.
That's how much, by the way, 4th edition is hated. It's been stricken from existence.
Oh, no, there's all kinds of threads about... If you look at 4th edition, there's all kinds of threads about... was it underrated? Is it the worst version?
The actual truth of it is, it has, like almost anything. When you're out long enough, you experience a little bit of a reconsiderization. Reconsiderization?
Yeah.
A reconsideration or a little renaissance. And there are people who will speak positively about it now. It actually did well for us. Mm-hmm. But
I still own my 4th edition stuff, some of it.
I was just the other day telling somebody about a mechanic in it that I thought was cool. Oh, mm-hmm. Serena was telling me about your Ebron game, and there's mm-hmm. a thief, and the thief had some kind of powers in which they could move people around a little on the board.
Yeah, it was like the Mastermind ability, yeah.
And I said, this sounds like the Warlord.
The Warlord was such a great class. That was the one thing I wish they'd brought into 5e.
Yeah, it was a cool idea where you could issue commands and have people, like, flank him or whatever, and, you know, the guy could move, but without, like, maybe triggering attacks of opportunity.
Yeah,
that was neat.
The Rogue Mastermind archetype does something similar, but it's much more... He basically can give advantage to one dude.
Right, right.
It's not... The Warlord was, like, basically all about helping other people do stuff. It was a cool class.
Let's hear it for 4th edition.
Yeah. Let's bring it back.
All right, do we got some new games this week?
Yes, so, new games. Warhammer 40K RPG has Imperium Maledictum, which is about a new sector. It's a sort of a sector-specific source book.
Yeah. Everything sounds cool when you say it, like, in Latin.
It's true. Ark Nova, the basically terraforming zoo, a very popular game. Uh-huh. Gets their Marine World expansion. So if you want to build a Sea World and then be sued by the people who say that you're mistreating your animals, Marine World is the way to experience that. G.I. Joe Faction Fighters Volume 1 is for the G.I. Joe RPG.
This is the wildest.
If you ever want to play, say, Tiger Force.
Or Python Patrol.
Be a part of Python Patrol. Or maybe part of Cobra Law.
Oh, is Cobra Law in there?
Cobra Law is in there.
Yeah, interesting.
You know what's weird, Nick? So I looked at it yesterday, and it's fun, because it is like, this is the weirdest side of G.I. Joe. The most sort of
the
strange and
factions?
Superhero-y stuff and odd things that they did. It probably has, like, I feel like it has, like, Toxo Vipers and other stuff like that.
I feel like this should have been, like, Volume 3.
So you're saying Battleforce 2000 is in this?
They're not. Volume 1 should have been Ninjas, which they have not really covered, Dreadnoughts, and maybe Battleforce 2000. Volume 3 is where you get to Tiger Force. And
that's actually not true. Tiger Force was pretty prominent in the 90s. Was
Tiger Force, that wasn't the UK one?
No. Tiger Force was
that's
like
Action
a...
Force.
Oh, that's right. Tiger Force was the kind of the repaints and repaints.
They were like subset, like a secret group within G.I. Joe that did specific operations.
Yeah, all Tiger related.
Yeah, all Tiger related.
I flipped through it yesterday. It does, like, it looks like it has, like, you know, feats and origins and things from all of these ones. It actually, and the same way, Randy, that the lore, though, of the early game, that, you know, was kind of neat to read how they integrated sort of lore from all the different sources and into a gameplay element where it's like, oh, you know, the players have mentors who are like the long-timer Joes and all stuff like that. They had some stuff like that in this, too, that I thought was pretty cool about how, like, well, you know, the Tiger Force Joes, that they don't, you know, although... you know, stealing or whatever is not something that G.I. Joe generally frowns upon, or that it is something they frown upon, but that they have to, you know, this represents a more lean and on-the-move team of Joes where they have to appropriate enemy weaponry. They'll repaint it and redesign it a little bit, but that's why you'll have, like, a, you know, a Hiss tank or whatever, but it's, you know,
that's
branded with
cool,
it.
That's kind of cool, actually.
And I was like, yeah, that they made it sound cool, and yet you can also have weird Cobra Law origins. You could be even, Nick, a defector from Cobra Law, like a decent, a good guy Cobra Law.
I don't
Law.
Think that happens.
Well, they have a bit of on the philosophy. If they're like, if it feels like it's breaking the rules, the concept too much, then don't do it.
I feel like Calobulus would just kill you.
Nick, do you think that that happens to every single person? You think there could not be a well-written story about a guy who escaped him?
No, I think it's good. I'm just saying
cool
you would
guards?
Be hunted. You would be hunted.
You know those cool main, those guys who are just their drones?
Yeah.
Those guys are cool. Even being one of those dudes would be cool.
Yeah.
But they had like weird sticks.
You could be a G.I. Joe Law.
Yes, that's... You might want to change the name, but yes, you can do that.
You're right.
Anyway,
Cobra Law is so much cooler.
It is a weird little supplement, but it looked to me like it did a good job at kind of embracing and like making some of that weirdness pretty cool.
Their writing is always so good. Like that whole RPG has been really good. Well, my only gripe, the only reason I'm salty,
uh-huh.
is we're four books into this, four books and I think a year or two into
and
this game.
And they've yet to get to Arashikage.
Where are the damn ninjas? People love the ninjas.
Where's the blind
man? The cover of this has three of the best G.I. Joe vehicles. Has the ferret, which is a G.I. Joe version of, it's their version of the Cobra ferret. The four-wheeled... Well, no, it's like the... It's the Tiger Force version of the Cobra Ferret. The Snow Cat, the Tiger Force version of that, and then the Cobra Stinger, which is...
If I'm correct, the Snow Cat just becomes like a regular kind of vehicle for them and not a snow vehicle.
Correct.
Even though it's got treads on it, which are probably meant for snow.
Yeah. They're tank treads.
I mean, the whole deal with this is you don't want to ask too many questions. Does it look cool painted, not snowy white? Yeah, it does. Like now it's a cool ground vehicle, just a normal vehicle. You don't have to go on the snow.
meanwhile, over the Power Rangers RPG, there is a Time of Night. That's K-N-I-G-H-T.
It's time travel
adventure.
It's
a time
Power
travel
Rangers.
Adventure, yeah.
Yes, it led to me to go off on a weird philosophical tangent the other day, wondering if they go back in time to, like, King Arthur times, which I believe is what happens.
Sure.
It's like Knight with a K. Do they still end up having to, at the end of every adventure, and does the game work this way in general, fight a big giant monster?
Yes, and it's Morgan Le Fay.
I mean,
it's
I think it would
Morgan
be, but no, but like, you know, it would be like, there could be lots of things. It could be a weird giant griffin kind of thing.
Could be a war elephant. I hear King Arthur has war elephants.
Yep, that's in one of the greatest King Arthur stories of all time.
By Guy Ritchie?
No, that's not. I assume there's a giant dragon. Because there has
to be. Oh, that makes sense. Dragons versus Megazords.
I looked on the back of it, and there was like...
Well, the cover has a giant dragon.
If there is, but doesn't it look like the show's kind of aesthetic?
I mean, kind of. It looks very D&D-ish, though.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, like, I feel like everything needs to have the kind of Super Sentai Japanese aesthetic to it.
Yeah.
Even if you're in Arthurian times, whatever the monster is, even if it is Morgan Le Fay, Morgan Le Fay needs to look like Rita Repulsa when she becomes giant.
It's true. Steve Jackson Games is another... They occasionally get these games where it's like, oh, this is definitely going to be popular, called We Love Cats. And all you need to know is it comes with two dice that have cats on it and 10 cat tokens.
Sure.
Delightful.
It's a little tiny game.
Delightful.
Girl My Moonlight, which is a new game from Evil Hat Games, the people who brought you Thirsty Sword Lesbians, among many others. Fate. This is a Fate-based, I don't know if to describe maybe Buffy-esque.
Okay.
I haven't actually looked over the whole thing yet.
What's it called again?
Girl by Moonlight.
Girl by Moonlight. That does sound... Oh, God. I'm trying to remember if I read about this one. Is it the one that has magical girl elements?
Yes.
But kind of also... It's not magical girl like everybody is Sailor Moon in it. It's magical girl as a more of a broad genre that would include stuff like Buffy and things like that.
Yeah, I think
like
that's
that.
Right. That's
and I was like, oh, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, Fate System's good. Thirsty Sword Lesbian's good. So,
We got Ticket to Ride Legends of the West, which we've been talking about before, but this is the
Legacy
version of Ticket to the Ride with the original designer of Ticket to
Ticket
Ride.
To the Ride?
Ticket to the Ride. Alan R. Moon is the designer of Ticket to Ride.
Uh-huh.
Matt Leacock, the designer of the original Legacy games. No, that's Pandemic Guy.
I don't know.
Whoever the designer is of the original Legacy games.
Like the Risk ones and
stuff
like that?
Rob DeVoe.
Yeah, okay.
Rob DeVoe. They both worked on it. So you've got these two like legends of their... Like, this is the guy who originated Ticket to Ride, and the guy who originated Legacy games doing a Ticket to Ride Legacy game where you build a railroad in the Old West.
That sounds pretty cool.
It looks pretty awesome.
Somebody picked it up yesterday. I'm looking forward to his review from it. He was somebody who had some experience with Legacy games. I think he's playing Pandemic Legacy Season 1 right now, which we played and had a good time with. Yep. Like, I really liked that. I'm looking forward to hearing back. I have a feeling that they're probably going to come through on this. It feels like those guys generally know what they're doing.
If I hadn't just picked up the Sagrada Artisans Legacy game, and so I already have a Legacy game on deck, I would definitely, this would be a day one buy for me. I'm definitely looking forward to it.
You know what that customer said his favorite Legacy game is? The Machi Koro game.
That was super fun.
I haven't played, but I remember you telling me it was good.
Really enjoyed it. Never got to finish it because pandemic.
Yep. Oopsie.
Magic the Gathering has their new Lord of the Rings. This is their second batch of this.
Yep.
It's a limited edition. Comes in, what, like a gift pack?
So there's jumpstart packs.
Right.
There's a collector boosters. And there are, I think they're called scene boxes, where six cards form a, they can be played separately, of course, but they create a, like, art
tableau.
Scene. Oh. Yes, a tableau.
Oh, interesting.
Which are very pretty. And there's an Arwen one.
Okay.
Aragorn, Witch King, and
do you get to get which one you want? Or
yeah, you get to get. Oh. No, you get to get. There's four different ones, and I can't. And I think that might be all of them.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
They're very pretty, and the art on all of this is it's Magic the Gathering level. Here is gorgeous artwork.
Yeah, the quality that they've kind of become known for.
But yeah, they look nice.
Then we got just off the box from Kickstarter, we got a game called Mercurial, which is a game where you're a spellcaster. It's a card and dice manipulation game themed on spellcrafting, and it's sort of an engine builder.
Okay.
So basically, you have different starting resources, and you're trying to build spells by using dice and cards and that kind of thing. Looks very cool. And that's our games. Let's talk about comics for the week. Let's talk about. So about Transformers number 2.
I was going to say, let's talk about the best book.
This is the
we don't usually start with a number 2 of an issue, but we do when it's like our favorite. So ha ha ha.
We all love number 1, and I think we all love number 2.
Yeah. Number 2 is great. There's a guest star in it that we won't spoil.
Will we not? Okay.
No, I don't think we should.
I'll tell you who it is. But yes, it is a very cool.
I definitely did not know about the guest star when I was reading it. So
there is a Optimus Prime interacting with Earth's wildlife in a way I've never seen. I thought it was really well done.
Yep. And Starscream is a maniac.
Oh yeah.
You know Joe Pesci in Goodfellas?
Yeah.
That's a good yeah.
That is what Starscream feels like, only it's like if Joe Pesci was running the Decepticons.
But you know what's funny is I've always liked Transformers, but I've never felt this, and they've done it occasionally, but this, the notion of like the Decepticons feel so much more powerful right now.
Yeah.
Like they landed, they just went immediately after energy. Optimus and the Autobots are completely down and out. And they're like, well, we need to figure out a way to get energy. And Starscream and the Decepticons like, oh, let's just grab it from here. And there is, they feel like they're being a little held back by their nobility. And it's, it's a really interesting thing.
They have some morals and will not squish people.
Yep.
And Starscream is like, not only will I squish people, but I will seek it out.
I will seek out the chance to squish people.
Also, a great new take on Cliff Jumper. And his...
I think it's safe to say at this point, since the first issue is out, that Cliff Jumper is probably going to be somewhat taking the place of Bumblebee as the, you know, not second in command, but as, like, the earnest, sort of younger, I guess, Autobot. But he's not, like, that close to Bumblebee. He's more of a headstrong dude, a risk taker.
Like other versions, Cliff Jumper is what Bumblebee should have been. He's, like, the secret spy.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be, like, the ultimate badass. And I would assume we're going to get some variation of that for Cliff Jumper.
Yeah.
But I like his first introduction to the human race and his response. It was quite amazing.
Yeah, great.
Also, the art on this, we don't always mention how great this art is. It is really good. His take on Optimus Prime transforming is a great panel.
You know what's funny is I haven't heard back from a lot of people on this, but like there just sometimes people they'll venerate say the Dreamwave era of Transformers because those are the ones that had like the most detail and kind of looked most like almost like production art that you would have like on a packaging and stuff like that.
Right.
But the storytelling was never amazing for that. And the storytelling was a little iffy, I would say, on some of the IDW stuff, too. But Daniel Warren Johnson knows how to tell a story, and as well as being a good artist.
Well, there's...
And so he doesn't, like, do... He doesn't draw the Transformers. He draws them a little bit more like the way they were in the old Marvel time era, where it's not, like, a bazillion little details. It's... But they read very clearly. Yeah. Their actions are very clear. And when they're doing stuff, let me tell you, the stuff that Starscream does in this one aerial fight, it is dope.
It's well, cool there's kind of an interesting story there, because he was interviewed and he was saying that...
Starscream?
Yes, Starscream.
Starscream likes to give interviews.
No, Daniel Warren John, actually, he probably
I have some
would.
Strong opinions about Megatron.
Let me tell you what I think about The Godfather.
Now Starscream is canceled.
No, but Daniel Warren Johnson was interviewed, and I think he was saying early on he was trying to do a more structured, very kind of, not robotic, but kind of get those lines like a little bit more...
Right.
What he thought they should be.
Right, you needed a very tight mechanical
because
look.
You're drawing cars and planes and trucks.
But
and
he did not end up there?
No, because he had to sort of break his brain a little bit to get back to his own style. He was trying to do a Transformer style.
Right.
And he was like, no, I need to do this in sort of a more energetic kind of...
Well, it's like you can imagine that he is, as if these were people.
Yeah.
Like he is, that he might be like the undersketch of them. Would be just like just the same as drawing a person, you know, the same movements and angles and stuff you would have on a person, but it's going to end up covered with these sort of blockier shapes and stuff. But that means it reads almost like the way animators do things.
Yeah.
It reads very clearly.
And I want you to go through here and look at all the sound effects. And
awesome.
People should take note. These sound effects are what you want for sound effects to sound like.
Well, you know, it's they're kind of like because
I just
Japanese...
opened up to 1-2-page spread, and there's like 12 different sound effects on here, and they're amazing.
Well, what he does is they it's almost like in manga when the sound effects are integrated as a visual, first of all. So, like, you might not even notice quite what they are spelling out at first, but they create the shape, kind of. They add to the art.
Yes.
And then you can kind of look, and you're like, oh, yeah, this is mimicking the sound from the cartoon, you know, like, whether it's like some kind of pew-pew or the transforming sound or a jet going by. Yes, they are... They are integrated with the art, which, you know, the first time I saw somebody do that was probably when Walt Simonson did it in Thor in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, like, they always do, like, you know, just somebody getting punched in by Captain America and it says pow. But there were certain artists, a lot of times when there was the writer and artist, that's when they kind of were most thoughtful about that.
Right, right.
And Johnson's really good at it.
And
so
he just does break your thing. He is an artist and writer.
I know. There's the rare exception.
Randy would have to acknowledge there's exceptions.
There are exceptions.
But they prove the rule. The rule is there for a reason, people.
We still have issue number one of Transformers.
All of Void Rivals.
And all of Void Rivals.
Which you don't have to read.
No. You could just read Transformers.
That's a kind of fun little side story about, like, it's really very much, at least in its start, like Enemy Mine.
Yeah.
With some an original two alien original alien civilizations at war,
and as they go on,
but
sort of
but it bumps
on it.
Up against Cybertron stuff.
Yep.
Yeah,
and like light spoiler warning, including some of the stuff from that was like Transformers movie and onward in the old cartoons. So I'm going to just
this one,
the Quintessons and stuff like that. They're in there.
I think where it's going to lead. I think they're calling this the Energon universe. I think Energon is going to be the central theme. It's going to be a rare energy that everyone needs, whether you're a galactic civilization, a giant robot civilization, or a energy starved Earth civilization. I believe the G.I. Joe Cobra is going to fall.
What if we are the Walking Dead?
We are the Walking Dead.
What if we are the Energon starved universe?
All I'm just saying is, try this one out. I think you're going to like it.
This is honestly maybe the most exciting comic of the year. It's doing something really cool.
It's not just a toy license. Yeah. They're doing something unique with Transformers.
I am a bigger G.I. Joe fan than Transformers fan. I always have been. And this is a delight. I am really enjoying it. All right. Let's talk about Marvel's big launch of the week. And that is The Punisher number one. You might be saying, but The Punisher. But Randy, Frank Castle is dead. How can there be a Punisher? And if you are saying that, probably you're like one of three people who have read Jason Aaron's run all the way to the end.
But you should, because it was a good
story. It was a good run. But yes, Frank Castle's dead. He's in hell. this is a new character. It was written by David Propose, who's been doing Savage Avengers and a few other things. And he is an ex-SHIELD agent whose family is killed and who goes on a rampage.
Yep.
And who is his family killed by?
A Sokovian called the Sokovian.
Yep. But for a different group of individuals hiding in the shadows. So it there are some.
Do we know the name of the individuals hiding in the shadows?
No.
Like Hydra or something like that?
No. Okay. There are some parallels to Frank Castle's story that are used here.
Yep.
But
and Randy also, I think, pointed out there's a little bit of John Wick energy, too, in this guy who, like, them biting off more than they could chew when they killed this guy's family.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think everybody, like, he was. The cops investigating him are like, yeah, he was an accountant.
That was
clearly a cover because his tech person, who's called AAA, and she was his tech person at S.H.I.E.L.D.
You know what? Instead of John Wick, I think my brain would draw conclusions that this is more like Nobody. Because he was an accountant. Wasn't he supposed to be an accountant?
Nobody?
The one with the guy from Better Call Saul.
Oh, I guess. I mean, I've seen that, but... she says she's like, it's been a long time since you were the gravedigger of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I'm like, okay, so like, he was known for like taking out people and all that kind of thing.
And so what you're going to see is a Punisher type character using some tech that'd be S.H.I.E.L.D. level.
Yep.
But a little, like sometimes S.H.I.E.L.D. is a little bit pew pew lasers.
Yep.
And this is a little bit more like, I just fired a rail gun through a bad guy.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool. I believe people will either find the explanation of kind of why they might be calling him the Punisher when he does not self-identify as the Punisher immediately.
No.
They're either going to find that a little bit goofy or kind of entertaining, as you did, Nick.
Yeah.
I'm still making up my mind on it. Oh, by the way, the big antagonist in it, the guy he has to fight who's like a superhuman type threat, is a good one. I like this character. And I think he's a good one to put up against Punisher early on.
Yeah, no, it's a solid first issue if you're looking for a new Punisher book.
Right, that I think vibes more closely with classic Punisher than, say, the previous edition did, where he was sorting it up and working with the hand.
Yep. There's a new Thanos book. This is by Christopher Cantwell, who's done a variety of things at Marvel Comics and DC Comics. And Dave, you said the pitch for this is basically it is Thanos versus the Illuminati.
That was my understanding. Yep. I have not read it, but when I was making the sign and I looked at their own solicit for it and stuff like that, I believe that's how they ran it.
Yep.
Which seems like a solid enough idea. You know, the Illuminati, of course, includes Beyonce, Jay-Z. And
this is not the classic Illuminati. I'll say
Tom Hanks.
As I look at it, it is a new Illuminati.
Is it okay?
Yep.
I was like, it has been a little while since that's been a major thing at Marvel, like, you know, 10 years or something like that. But it's probably percolated in there.
There's no Black Panther, there's no Namor. It's a very different.
Originally, it was like those guys, but also Iron Man, Doctor Strange, Reed Richards, sort of the big thinkers or big leaders, and they were like the cause of like, Planet Hulk, which MCU people know as sort of the Hulk from Thor Ragnarok.
Yep.
And then when Hulk came back angry about having been stranded on a gladiator world, which they were like, oh, oops, we didn't mean to do that. He came back and they had World War Hulk where he beat everybody up on Earth. That was essentially the plot of it.
Everybody
on Earth has to get beat up by the Hulk for wronging him.
Yep.
And, kudos to the Hulk. He did it.
Sure.
I feel like, although they eventually stopped him somehow, I don't remember how, he did beat up everyone. I got beat up by the Hulk. In the year 2006 or whatever.
I remember
that.
It was tough.
Yeah, it's why I still have a bad knee.
And then we've got a new What If. This is the Tomb of Dracula. Marvel's been going back to like original creators to do like dark What If stories.
Yep.
So this is Tomb of Dracula creator Marv Wolfman.
He's the creator of the basically Marvel's version of Dracula.
Well, he created Blade.
And he created Blade.
Yep. So this is a story about what if Blade had basically been turned full vampire by Dracula.
Yep.
And that's kind of what it's about. It
AKA
is,
a Blade Dracula team up.
It is a riff on Tomb of Dracula. If you have any fondness for those, I definitely recommend it. Hmm. DC has Superman 78, The Metal Curtain.
Right. They've already did one Superman 78 series. You know, it's the Christopher Reeve movie stuff. Same as they did, what, Wonder Woman 77?
Batman 89.
Batman 89, yeah. Nick, I think we both kind of like this.
I did. I mean, I thought it was just a good, fun little Superman story that kind of fits in. Soviets as the bad guys.
Yep. They have. You know, I thought it was going to be one thing when I read about it. I was like, oh, there's a Soviet super soldier. And I was like, this is going to be kind of like the goofy Solar Man and Superman Quest for Peace movie.
Yeah.
And it's actually a much cooler idea. It's another bit of Superman lore. And I didn't know what it was until, like, the last page. And I was like, oh, that's actually neat.
Yeah.
But along the way, there's some good, like, you know, classic superheroics with Lois. There's some fun stuff at the Daily Planet. You know, that sort of banter that, you know, those they had in those movies. You know, Margot Kidder and whoever the dude was who played Perry.
I think I was really taken by the artwork. Yeah. I think this guy, Gavin Goodry, is very talented, especially with his sort of emotiveness of characters.
And he's also, like just good with all of his basic storytelling. You know, he reminds me of, like, one of those artists like Chris Samnee or somebody like that, who, you know, a lot of the people who worked on Mark Waid's Daredevil run, who kind of had the clean line style.
Yep.
So he does a good job of, like, do these people look like, you know, just exactly like perfect caricatures of the movie people?
No.
Not exactly, but there were some moments where he, like, I feel really captures, like, Margot Kidder's expressions or Christopher Reeves. And I think it's a little bit more important is his storytelling is really, really clean and readable.
It is.
You're
never confused as to what action is going on.
Right. Which sometimes people who are good at drawing caricatures, you know, they're good at following photo reference, are not the best storytellers.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a good balance that has this elements of the movie's vibe. And I want to see him go up against the threat that is promised on the last page.
Yeah, I think if you're just a Superman fan in general, this is one to check out.
Yeah, it's a pretty classic take on Superman.
Boom also has a new thing from their Boombox line, which is like their all-ages line called Zawa and the Belly and the Beast.
Yep.
I don't know much about it.
It's kind of a post-apocalyptic, weird kind of world where people are kind of starved, and there's a cooking element in this that's interesting.
Okay.
It reminds me a lot of, like, a Scotty Young type take on it.
Scotty Young, Studio Ghibli-ish.
Yeah.
Okay,
all
right.
I mean, I don't want to spoil anything because that kind of gives away stuff, but it was very beautiful. It's done by Michael Dielness. I don't know this person, but he both wrote and drew it. I thought it was a good start.
Nice. There's a bunch of graphic novels this week. I'm just going to run a few of them down. This is definitely not all of them. There was a lot this week. But there's a Cyberpunk 2077 Library Edition. For those who like Cyberpunk comics, it's an oversized, collects several of them together. There is the Daredevil by Mark Waid Omnibus that's back in print. So if you would read one of the best reads...
Yeah, we were just... I brought up Chris Samnee's art on that, and that... Just in general, that run was smoking.
There's a new deluxe hardcover of DC's New Frontier, the Darwin Cook masterpiece. There is Echo, the Saga of Maya Lopez, just in time for the Echo trailer that just dropped, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. There are the Dungeons & Dragons novels for the movies, The Druid's Call and The Road to Neverwinter, one of which focuses on the Druid, the other one focuses on the Bard, Edgin.
Yep, they are prequels.
Yeah.
They are prequels to the movie.
We've got Heroes Feast Flavors of the Multiverse.
The sequel.
The new cookbook for the Heroes Feast cookbook was one of the best-selling things in the store. Still sells all the time.
Yep.
I was flipping through this yesterday, and it looked like a great follow-up.
Yep.
Like, I can't believe how good the photos in it are.
Yeah.
And their little bits of lore are all fun, too. The lore are just, like, fun flavor text. See what I did there? But like, the recipes all look legit. So that there was, like, what was it? It's like, you can make the Kender Cobbler based on, like, Dragonlance, because this is multiverse theme. There's like some like more like hearty food from what's the big inn that's like over Under Mountain?
Yawning Portal.
Yawning Portal. Yeah, there's a Yawning Portal like meals. I feel like stuff from the Underdark, stuff from Sigil, the city of doors.
Yeah.
And yet most of these are thematically all, you know, very eatable stuff.
Yeah.
It's I even saw there was a Herringen, their rabbit people dish, which was a kind of glazed carrots that sounded pretty good, to be honest.
All right. the hardcover collection of TMNT, The Last Ronin, Lost Years, which is the prequel series to The Last Ronin.
Yep.
If you want to read that just in time for TMNT, Last Ronin 2, which hits this year.
Yep. That hasn't started yet?
It's not started yet.
That's right.
Superman Supercorp, which collects the first six issues of the Joshua Williamson run.
Some good stuff there.
The two of the three of the DC manga that have been coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Get their Volume 2s this week. The Batman Justice Buster has already come out, I think.
And there's already been a volume of the one where Superman is eating ramen and
That Volume 2 came out this week.
Yeah.
Right, but there's been a Volume 1.
Yes. Yes. Right, yeah. Yeah, there's been a Volume 1 of all of them.
Yeah.
So this is Volume 2 of the Joker 1 Operation Joker. And yes, Superman versus Mishi, which features Superman flying around with Batman on his back, feeding him stuff so he can fly.
These are both bonkers manga.
It's bonkers, yeah. Yeah. There's also Transitions, which is the a graphic novel from the point of view of a mom whose kid transitions at, like, age 19, which is very interesting. And man, there's all kinds of stuff, but I'm looking to see anything else particularly like, oh, I should mention this. I guess worth mentioning that new volume of Nocterra, for those who are enjoying that run.
Third volume.
And yeah, I think that's probably about all the highlights.
I've got some Strays here.
Okay, and I've got some Strays as well. Okay. Go ahead.
So we should mention Batman 139.
Yes.
Start of a storyline that has the Joker in it, who has not been in the Bat books actually for some years now.
Yep.
It's been several years since he's made a major appearance, even though you might have fought him in a video game or seen him in a movie or something.
He's had a set series.
But he wasn't there.
Yep.
That was a fake Joker.
And this seems to be, interestingly, this has the very driven Batman of powered by the Zur-En-Arr kind of persona. And it seems like it's tying into the Three Jokers concept as well. So something's going to give on there, and I think there's going to probably be some
crazy versus crazy.
By the end, there'll be four Jokers.
Let's see, there's third issue of Birds of Prey, which I believe we've all been liking that series.
This is, I think, one of the series that people need to check in on, because it's a delight.
I agree. It's my favorite Birds, you know, Birds of Series Prey gets relaunched every once in a while, and I think this is my favorite one in many, 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 many years.
Yeah. Well, the conceit is Black Canary is trying to sneak onto Themyscira.
Yeah,
and how she does
like a heist team.
And puts together a heist team, and how she does it, and how she gets there. This is all just wonderful stuff.
They're real scared of Wonder Woman.
I mean,
They are like, we have to do this. We talked about this when the first issue came out, because the first thing was like, let's just ask Wonder Woman for help, and we're like, if she says no, we are hosed.
Yeah, that was such a good explanation.
Yep,
it was nice and simple. And it's got like, it's got Barda on it. It's got Harley Quinn. It's
Cassandra
got Batgirl. Kane. Cassandra Cain, Batgirl, Zealot from Wildstorm
This issue really is...
This is like the break-in issue.
Zealot should not work in a DC universe, but she does.
Yeah, they're using her well. Like, she's like the kind of mysterious, weird ninja of the group.
Yeah, they did something here that's never been her power, I think.
Nah, I don't know.
And I was like, that's cool. So basically you just kind of repurpose the character, and there's some great moments in there. I love their interaction between Harley and Barda.
Yep.
And Barda and the Bat. I love the use, the character who's in here, their guest star, which makes perfect sense, that they use to try to distract Diana. And I love the base up at the end of this thing, the stuff they called out from the very beginning, the birds have come home to roost.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a great cliffhanger of a final page.
Yeah.
I am super enjoying this
book. And I think we all really like the art on it, too.
Oh, yeah, the art's great.
Leonardo Romero,
yeah,
killing it.
No, I can't wait for more of this. I'm really enjoying this book.
Spidey kicks off a new storyline, Gang War. I have no idea what's going on in this.
Gang War does not kick off here. I want to be clear about that.
Yeah, this is a
Gang
kind of War.
All this is on the cover. It says Gang War is coming.
All right. He's down.
No, it's very important. People don't think this is the start of Gang War.
It has a giant Gang War logo on it.
Yes, but what else
saying.
Does it have, Dave?
I don't know. The Marvels ad?
No, it has Rec-Rap.
Rec-Rap. It has Rec-Rap. I want people to be clear. Rec-Rap is not going to be in Gang War. So if you don't like Rec-Rap,
okay.
Go right off Gang War.
All right. All right, so don't read that, y'all.
Look, we stay positive. I like to stay positive, but this is one of the worst Spider-Man covers I've ever seen in my life.
It is a weird one.
And so I don't want to tarnish Gang War, which I'm actually kind of looking forward to. It looks kind of exciting.
Yeah. Did we mention this one?
No.
No, we have not.
Image has a comic called Petrolhead, I feel like this is one you're going to want to flip through for visuals alone, if nothing else. This has, like, futuristic robot racers in a kind of dystopian setting, but it's like it's got Speed Racer kind of vibes the robot racers are like, the lead one is a robot who chomps a cigar and is like a Ben Grimm tough guy racer. The art's super dope in it. I have no idea how the story is, but I feel like this might be one of those you might want to pick up purely for visuals alone. So it's called Petrol Head. And lastly, just for bonkersness, there's a facsimile reprint of All-Star Comics number 3. This is like an old JSA comic. It's got like, it's one of those puffy comics of old that's probably like 40, 50 pages and has like, oh, here's an Hourman story, here's an original Green Lantern story, here's a Spectre story.
You showed me the Spectre story, and that was pretty crazy.
It's wild. You know, I was trying to figure out what the Spectre was like in those old stories.
Yeah.
It starts out with just like, there's been murders, and it's how mysterious. But then eventually, he and the guy who are the murderer are fighting in the cosmos, and they're like, the Spectre's like grabbing onto a shooting star that looks, and like, they're standing on top of planets. Now, it's presented more almost that weird little Nemo dreamlike quality. It's not like, you know, the Spectre is an awesome towering figure of God's vengeance, as he would be kind of re-lensed in the 90s. But he was up to some crazy shit. and everything in this is crazy. I feel like there's at least a few racist depictions of things as well. This is interesting, and the art, the variety of art styles is different, is pretty cool. Some better than others. But I feel like if you pick this up, you're going to get the bang for your buck of you're going to see what it was like to be in the 1940s.
I want to mention the final issue of Marvel Unleashed. Did you read that, Nick?
So good.
It's a fantastic read.
Oh, so like, it wraps up
really strong. And I was not expecting that emotional gut punch of an ending.
I wasn't expecting it either, but it's really well done.
It is.
I got behind on that when I went on vacation, so I guess I will probably hold out for the trade paperback, but
it's
I'm glad to hear it ended well.
Yeah, it was really good. I'm glad they did it. Anything else?
The fourth issue of the Enfield Gang Massacre. I'm still really enjoying that series. And then the second issue of Marvel Gods, which...
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm the only one at the table who has a chip still down for Jonathan Hickman.
That's correct.
And he still...
But you're not the only person in the store.
No. And I really am enjoying this series. I kind of like that they're using the Marvel characters, but creating some new heroes to kind of seed some new stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's some new organizations, and I know, Randy, you like organizations.
Nick, the first one you said you had elements of what you thought was sort of like a Doctor Who vibe.
Yeah.
Is that still going on? I think each issue is like a different focus,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is a different... They're each different character focuses. This one sort of focuses on the other secret society that is kind of like the purveyors of science. They, like, worship the god of science.
Okay.
And it's about sort of, one of their characters kind of going after a person to sort of get them on their side, to join their ranks. There's other things afoot, but...
Is that a bunch of Marvel stuff in it?
Yeah, yeah. Doctor Strange is still a part of it.
Anybody
Wong
punch
shows
the Juggernaut?
Up. No, nothing as silly as that.
So it's not very Marvel-y.
He doesn't go, I'm the Juggernaut, bitch. and also Valerio. Valerio Shitty, or Shitty, I believe. Shitty.
You want to say it like Shitty.
Yeah, Shitty. is doing some fantastic artwork in this.
Miniseries?
I believe it is a 6-issue miniseries.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Presumably series of miniseries kind of thing.
Probably.
They will probably do more at some point. All right. Let us take a break for a moment, and then we're going to come back and talk about a whole mess of trailers and some other stuff. All right, we have numerous trailers to talk about here.
Yep, some movies, some TV stuff.
Let's start with Marvel's Echo. That's most germane to what we do, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, this is notable, it's not on this trailer, because they announced it right after the trailer came out, but they're launching a new, sort of an imprint for movies, which what do they call that? It's not called an imprint, but it's like an imprint, called Marvel Spotlight.
Oh, interesting, I hadn't heard this.
So the notion of it is in continuity, but it is not required, it's like less required viewing. Like, the notion is, this is a show you can get, like the Marvel Spotlight, where they're introduced new characters, where basically, if you haven't watched Hawkeye, where they introduced Echo, if you haven't watched... Hawkeye was introduced to Kingpin.
Yeah. It'll stand well enough on its own.
You don't have to watch anything else.
Hmm. Okay.
The notion being that, like, people are getting kind of tired of, like, well, how many movies do I have to watch? Right. Of course you don't, but you know, people get used to the idea.
Yeah.
And if you're not a comics fan, I mean, it can seem overwhelming. Me, I'm like, do you know how many thousands of comic books I've read?
Well, the MCU originally, I think, was like sold as everything's in continuity. You need to watch everything.
Right.
And that becomes
a detriment at some point. Yes. I think that this is their way of handling that. They're like, this is a Marvel Spotlight project. It's for you newbies.
It's funny because the movies are going through all the stages the comics have.
Yep.
And I don't necessarily think it's a bad idea.
No. It's just kind of funny to watch.
Yeah, you kind of have to adjust to the medium, adjust because, yes, there have been a lot of Marvel movies now and all that
stuff.
This
is a hell of a trailer. I have to say. I saw that it had popped up, and I was like, I'm not super interested. But this trailer makes me interested. The way that Kingpin and Echo are shown together and somebody, how they mirror each other. It's just a well put together trailer.
So somebody quick fill me in, even though I don't need to know it, on who is Echo?
So I guess the most important thing is in the show, in the MCU, she is the adoptive daughter of Kingpin.
Okay.
And that kind of happened in the comics.
He kind of helped raise her. Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep. She was his enforcer until she learned a secret about what happened to her parents and Kingpin's involvement in it.
Right.
And that sort of turns against her. I think this one looks to be jumping in time throughout her life and kind of her relationship with Kingpin and an enforcer.
What's her power in the comic, Nick? Is she the Echo thing? I know she's deaf.
Yeah, she's deaf.
But can she like mimic people's abilities?
I thought it was akin to like Taskmaster, or maybe not to that extent. Something she's like not a mutant, but she's super fighter.
But I think that's it. Like in the MCU, she is just a like really good fighter.
Yes. She's akin to like what Hawkeye was.
Yeah.
I mean,
when we get the characters who are basically Marvel characters who are just like pew pew shooters or punch punch fighters, I feel like I need some extra oomph to get my interest.
Yep.
And I'm not quite sure. This was a well done trailer, and it had like the edge of what looked like the Netflix Marvel stuff.
Yeah, it looks more like Netflix.
Like the Daredevil and the Punisher shows.
But more focused. It's not going to be 15 or 20 episodes. Which
if you told me that this was Marvel Max, I could definitely feel
that vibe.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Dave, you know, Kingpin wasn't enough of an edge to get you in. D'Onofrio's Kingpin.
It wasn't enough to get me to watch Hawkeye.
Oh man!
I also love that this is subtitled in
Choctaw. She's a Choctaw Indian,
And seems to show some backstory of like her ancestry, because we definitely see some elements of Native American.
Yeah.
In the trailer, I don't know. All the elements are there that and that kind of captured my interest. Where there was none.
What threw me off about this, the very thing that kind of makes it interesting, the edge, the kind of, there's some very brutal scenes in this. Is there a dude that looks like Kingpin, like shoots in the face?
It's somebody else. It's a very. John
but they
Wick-y.
Shoot basically right under the jaw.
He shoots him, and it's over. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's interesting because Disney Plus initially felt like it was defining itself as more tied into the movies than the Netflix shows. Netflix shows all like carried kind of an R-rated vibe, and the Disney Plus stuff was kind of more in line with the movies, a little less edgy. And in fact, Daredevil in particular, who ties into Kingpin stuff, was kind of this lighter-hearted character in the She-Hulk stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was like, oh. Are we reversing? Are we going back to?
No, I think there's at least some people who like we want this side of the MCU, which I'm conflicted on. I love crime stories.
Mm-hmm.
I love brutal crime stories. I don't necessarily love them in the MCU, so I'm not sure how to feel about this. But the trailer is so good that I'm definitely going to watch it.
I think there are characters that benefit from like an R rating.
There are. I mean, you don't really want a PG Punisher. You don't really. I mean. Daredevil can work that way, but you kind of want the grim and gritty a little bit. I get the appeal.
Right. Even swashbuckler Daredevil needs to, I think, veer a little bit edgy at times.
I know how you feel about it, but I know Deadpool is going to be the first R-rated MCU film. I've heard rumors that Blade is going to be R.
That would make sense.
I don't know that I feel like Blade should be, but that's the land.
It is the legacy of Blade.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I think some of these...
You can't say some mother lover is always trying to ice skate uphill.
I'm just saying, some of these... I can see Marvel branching out a little bit, trying a few more things, because word is that Marvel's lost it.
Mostly from Variety.
I know. I'm joking.
So what you're saying is Spider-Man should start dropping the F-bomb.
No.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yep. No.
Anyway, I'm not a huge fan of this character. I don't know her that well.
Well, she was originated by what? David Mack and Bendis?
Bendis, yeah.
Yeah.
Do we have a sense of what the story is beyond probably a strained, weird familial connection to the Kingpin?
Well, you've seen Hawkeye, Dave.
I know, Randy?
I was going to say, at the very end of Hawkeye, they kind of imply that she shoots Kingpin in the head.
Yeah.
Okay.
And kills him,
but that's
not everyone was like, there's no way Kingpin's dead. They don't bring him back for that.
But this is sort of, I think, the continuation of that story.
Yes, it is. Okay. It's for sure.
So it is, you can watch it
shooting somebody in the head isn't a story. But
it's like, what does she do if that doesn't work? Does she go on a John Wick rampage in order to take down Wilson Fisk?
It's a bit like that line, which I know was a paraphrase anyway, in The Usual Suspects. It's like, you know, how do you shoot the devil in the back? What happens if you miss?
Yeah.
And they don't actually show it. Right. So she could have missed.
Right. Or gotten squeamish and done the side shot, sort of.
Yeah.
What was this, like, during a conflict, or was it like she walked up behind him execution style?
No, it was in a conflict.
Oh, okay.
And it's Vincent.
No, she kind of executed him. Like, they were in a hall.
He was down on his knees.
Yeah.
That's very execution style. Yeah. That suggests to me that she couldn't do it, which fits into the strained pattern that these kind of things often take, where you have a love-hate with somebody.
And also, we get more Vincent D'Onofrio as the Kingpin, mm-hmm. and I'm okay with that.
There's no doubting that he is he's a definitive Kingpin.
Yeah.
That is really the gift that Netflix gave us. I think the Netflix shows don't necessarily hold up, at least, especially not beyond the first season for the most part. But their casting
was really good.
Almost all on point with one very notable exception that proves the rule.
Yeah.
And you all know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It refers, of course, to the Punisher.
Bernthal can do whatever he wants.
Yep, Bernthal can do whatever he wants. All right. We have Reacher Season 2, which this is just pure fun, that series.
What's that on?
Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime, yeah.
Yeah, the Reacher novels are all pulp and just action-based. They're airport reads.
Right.
They're fun.
But it's pulp, but there's a mystery to be solved. It's just that he's going to punctuate that mystery with putting his fist in somebody's face.
And he's like 8 feet tall.
He's like 8 feet tall. I've watched most of the first season of this and it was very entertaining. It's the best kind of airplane reading.
Yes.
I think, you know, a page turner, the TV equivalent of
a
page turner.
But you know at the very beginning Reacher is going to succeed at whatever he does.
But they'll throw some obstacles his way that'll be, like, you know, threatening enough. And, of course, he has friends who can die.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, he's 100%. Like Constantine when it
he's
comes
a little
to that.
Bit Constantine.
But this is one of those a little bit like Wolverine and other characters like that where you kind of want to see this dude, the good guy, unleash on people.
Yeah. Right?
Because he's going to do it in a brutal way and it's going to be entertaining.
Great scene in this one where there's a guy watching him and he walks out and hits his car hard enough to set out his airbag.
I was like, why didn't I think of that? Have we not seen this before?
Yeah, that was actually very clever. I've never seen that.
And that's the thing. There's a lot of great action moments like that among the dialogue is pretty crackling and the lead, Alan Richardson?
Alan Richardson, yeah.
He is very charming.
Clearly born to play that role.
Yeah.
By the way, I believe the reason we haven't seen that before is generally we think a car needs a really pretty sizable impact to trigger its airbag. You wouldn't think that a normal person could do it, but Jack Reacher is like 8 feet tall and is like basically a Fast and Furious superhero man.
By the way, he was in Fast and Furious.
What the hell was Tom Cruise doing? Why do you think he could play this character?
I think he loved the books and he was looking for
another franchise.
But I mean, it is very clear that big part of Jack Reacher is the size. A giant man. I get that Tom Cruise is short, but man, you would think being a multimillionaire, leader of several franchises, married to Nicole Kidman, would have gotten him over his Napoleon complex.
Here's the thing about those movies, though. They're pretty watchable. Even the first one has the beloved Werner Herzog as the main villain. He's amazing in
this. There's a scene in this that I believe is maybe adapted from the books, from the same scene I think I saw in one of the Reacher things, and it was in the trailers for it, too, with Tom Cruise, where he went up, and I don't think he actually wrapped his hand in cloth like he does in this. He just put his hand through, like, a windshield, a window in a car, and punched somebody out, like, with, you know, in one hit. And, like, it was cool looking. It was well filmed. He can convey certain elements of the character, like his supreme confidence, which he does. He is always kind of like very mentally in control of a given moment, and he kind of like knows what his plan is and stuff. And I think that's what it was. But Cruz is like also always in a way part businessman.
Yeah.
You know, he's always looking for that franchise, looking for that thing, and well, so.
And this one looks to adapt. I don't know if it's like a later era Lee Child book or it might be mid, because there's been like 20.
Right, we didn't say something. What the plot was, but it involves his like
yeah.
team.
Yeah, his CID team, or well, he was an MP, and I think it was his like special.
It was like an investigative
team. And it looks like maybe one of them gets killed, and sort of others are being like sought
targeted
after
or something, yeah.
for basically something they investigated long
right.
ago.
Right, little did they know that they accidentally uncovered blank.
Right. And they band all together. And I think it's a pretty smart thing. A lot of the Reacher books can sometimes be very solitary because he's, like, basically on his own.
Right.
He's just the man
but
who
doesn't
travels.
But doesn't he usually have, like, that, what, Lady Cop, was it?
There are not very many reoccurring characters in
no.
the... they're usually he makes a friend or two in town, whatever town he's in.
Right.
He's got an old general pal that he kind of talks to every once in a while.
Well, you know, one thing that this does allow for is it means that there can be stakes because some of these people are probably going to die.
Right.
And if they make them kind of like fun characters or cool characters or interesting characters, then we're going to like want them to live. And so we know Jack Reacher might not die, but we're not so sure about like his boys.
Exactly. There's always stakes. And this is a fun trailer.
Which yeah. looks pretty good.
It really is. Then we got a couple sort of artsy trailers from FX on Hulu.
Yep.
We've got A Murder at the End of the World. Which, people shouldn't go to Alaska or Antarctica anymore.
No.
You always get murdered there.
It's true.
Yeah.
Or there's vampires.
In this case, top murderer Clive Owen is there.
Clive Owen.
Actually, I have no idea if he's like the murderer or what, but well, he's there and he's saying sinister things.
He seems sinister. He seems like maybe one of these Knives Out types billionaires. He's got like some kind of complex.
But if you told me to relay what the plot of this show is based on this trailer,
I
have no freaking
clue. People go to the
Arctic
or something.
Or Alaska.
There is a compound of sorts.
Yep.
Clearly,
there's a murder.
There's some murders, possibly multiple murders.
Yep.
And I think they're maybe trying to get out of the complex, the zone,
maybe,
the Arctic.
Yeah. But it's very moody. The characters are good. The cast is good.
Yeah,
the people who did it did the OA. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I like Emma Corrin, who's the lead. She was played the young Princess Diana in The Crown.
Oh, okay.
She was very good.
I have a fair amount of faith in FX. They don't always hit for me, but I will at least give this a shot.
It has a little Girl with a Dragon Tattoo kind of vibe
it does
to
have
it.
That vibe, yes.
And a little bit of horror vibe. There's almost a little bit of that sort of, you know, various Final Girl type movies and stuff
yeah,
like
yeah.
that.
And also, like, they keep shooting shots like the Court of Owls.
Yeah, so I was like, what's up with these masks?
Thing, yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing a secret society needs more than spooky, like,
I want to say
masks.
This is starting pretty soon. Like, it's like next week
it is,
or
it's
something.
Soon, yeah.
This is definitely going on my watch list.
Yeah. All right. The next FX was Shogun.
Right.
This was a big miniseries
in the
70s.
If you are an old person
yep.
or are familiar with old people, you may have heard them speak of this.
Or your ex-staffer, Dan Grendel, who knows all things
right.
Japanese.
He's traveled back in time to
yes.
belive Shogun.
Yes.
So, no,
the novel was like, this is kind of like, I feel like Godfather level. It's in
yes.
1975 by James Clavell.
By the way, so popular that I believe this story to be true. John Byrne has always suggested that Chris Claremont, the writer of X-Men during all its biggest eras,
uh-huh.
that this is why Wolverine got into Japanese culture
oh,
and lore and all
oh,
that stuff
interesting.
Was because of the influence of Shogun.
I could see that. So the plot of this, the basic quick thing is that there is an English pilot on a Dutch warship, and they are the first to reach Japan to try and establish trade. And they discover that Japan is this very strange and weird and dangerous land,
right?
And
kind of isolationist,
yeah.
and it's samurai times,
yes,
right?
That's
the backdrop
I'm
of all this
for
stuff.
The year to see if it says exactly when it takes place. Oh,
17. So I'm going to say 1768.
It begins in feudal Japan, some months before the critical Battle of Sakigahara in 1600.
Oh my god!
1600. Wow,
that was like Shakespeare times.
Yes. If Dan were here, we could ask him, and he would tell us all about that era.
Excruciating
detail. So is this
detail.
About, like, we definitely see a white guy.
Right, but really, you said that from what you understood, this is not one of those white savior things where a guy comes in and he's the best samurai.
This isn't the other Tom Cruise movie, The Last Samurai, where he is the savior?
This is almost the opposite of that. This guy, John Blackthorne, he comes in and he's like, yeah, we're gonna make a trade alliance, we're gonna disrupt the Portuguese Catholic relations with Japan and blah 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 blah. And it turns out that, oh no, I don't know what's going on here and I might get myself killed.
Oh, okay. Right.
This is oops, I stepped into a culture I didn't know anything about, which by the way, turns out it's relevant forever.
Yeah. And I think one of the leads is also maybe a geisha ninja assassin type. It seems like that's what's going on with her. I can't quite tell.
It was a pretty classy and cool looking trailer.
Yeah, it looks expensive as shit.
The guy that I recognized is it Hiroyuki Sanada?
Yes.
He's been in like everything.
A ton of stuff. Yeah,
And he's always good.
Always good.
Something I don't know is whether the original miniseries from like the late 70s or early 80s holds up. Do people still think that it's like really good? Was it really good, or was it just influential? And like the book was big. I don't actually know. Like, I'm kind of curious. Like, would it be worth watching or not? And so I don't hear it buzzed about too much, so maybe not.
IMDb has an 8.1 of 10.
It's pretty good.
And it says Google users 92% liked it.
That's pretty good.
Guess who's in it? Toshiro Mifune.
Wow,
in there.
Yeah.
Richard Chamberlain plays the lead.
I knew that.
John Rhys Davies.
Huh.
A.K.A. Sala.
A.K.A. an Englishman who doesn't always play Englishman.
Right.
Yes. I am interested in this in large part because of the production quality.
Yeah, the production quality is amazing.
Yeah.
And FX does normally do bad stuff.
So it's FX. Okay.
Yeah.
Miniseries. How many episodes do we know? Okay. Let's just go and say 7.
Sure.
Be sure to tune into the 7-episode Shogun, which may not be 7
episodes.
Set
in 1800s Japan, and it's a white saber narrative.
Yes. Just purely guess. And they fight cyborgs.
And they fight cyborgs.
At some point.
Okay. Sure.
All right.
At some point, Totoro is in there.
I have arranged this so that we now have diminishing returns of trailers as we go.
Interesting, because we saw some stinkers.
And we get to the worst one right before I'm going to pop in a treat at the end.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Very clever.
Right, so I'm curious if you all know
very
what order
clever,
we're going
Mr.
to be.
I mean, I have an inkling.
I know what's last.
I think you know.
I know what's last.
All right. Let's talk about The Fall Guy.
Okay.
Okay.
This should have worked for me.
Yeah.
It's Ryan Gosling. It's a remake of the 80s TV show, which starred Legion of the Majors.
Yep.
I didn't even realize that it was about... a stuntman who was a bounty hunter.
He was a bounty hunter on the side.
Yes.
On the side, yeah. That was like his moonlighting.
Stuntman gig is not a gig that pays enough, so he was a bounty hunter on the side.
Yep.
That is not the premise of this movie. And that's the first place it goes wrong for me.
Yeah.
But this is supposed to be, this is that sort of like goofy comedy action thing. I love a good action comedy, and I want the action to be a little dark. Like, I'm a Beverly Hills Cop, Midnight Run, Running Scared person. Yeah. I want the action to be a little real. This feels like the action is all part of the goof, and that's what's going to ruin it for me.
What was that movie where some guys fight on a train and they're trying to be quiet recently?
Bullet Train.
How was that?
Not good.
Well, considering this is...
Because that one looked like that kind of thing to me where it was goofy.
Well, there's a reason it looks like it, because it's the same director, David Leitch.
Oh, is that the same director?
Yes.
I did not like Bullet Train, so that would explain it.
Oh, and I liked Bullet Train. I thought it was fun.
Your mention of Beverly Hills Cop, that was a sort of a touchstone for me as well. I always remember, like, when Axel gets captured by the bad guys, I'm like,
dangerous.
He's in trouble.
Yeah.
He's in real trouble. People are going to die.
He is joking, because that's Axel.
Right.
But he's joking in the face of this guy who's like, oh, it's very amusing. I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
Like, it's better. Anyway, this is Ryan Gosling playing a stuntman, which, by the way, if you're going to get a guy to play a sort of a stuntman dude who's not the star, maybe don't get one of the best-looking stars in the universe to play him.
Yeah, there's got to be some rugged people out there.
He's pretty rugged looking.
I like Ryan Gosling. I like Ryan Gosling in comedy mode. Everybody should see The Nice Guys, which he is great in. He can play a lovable loser type.
Yeah.
But it is hard to remember that Ryan Gosling is not good looking as hell. And he is dating the director, who is played by Emily Blunt.
Yep.
I buy Emily Blunt as a director. I kind of like that. And his star, I can't remember who's playing the actual star that he's stunt doubling for.
I don't think it really matters.
It's somebody notable.
What?
He gets kidnapped, and the movie's in danger, and the only person they can send, the multi-million or billion-dollar Hollywood complex, they don't have bounty hunters on retainer with skills or detectives.
They don't have
to send their stuntman.
So Randy,
the whole thing fell apart for me right there.
Are you saying that the 1980s Lee Majors Fall Guy was more realistic?
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
I'm just saying, I mean, that... nowadays, I guess I can see you bumping on that. But yes. I mean, those kind of weird concepts worked in the 80s. I mean, Romancing the Stone, a novelist goes on an action-adventure tour.
But she didn't have the money to hire a private detective. Like
and she was like the best-selling romance she could have.
They would occasionally have weird violence in that, like a guy getting his hand horribly bitten off by a crocodile.
Look at those snappers.
Romancing the Stone works. This doesn't look like it's gonna. There's a vibe to movies where you can sort of see it. You can usually see in the trailer. I could be wrong. But I've seen enough of these trailers now where I'm like, there was a couple things going, I'm like, this looks like someone trying really hard to be funny.
And that might be David Leitch's style.
You know what it looks to me like? It looks like, to me, like what AI-written movies are going to look like.
Oh my god, yes.
No. Middling quips and editing and songs to try and oomph it.
And Ryan Gosling doing his best to make it work, because that guy, he is really good at this. There's some moments in here.
But Nick, you're going to press play. You're going to, like,
you're
gonna tell
us. I will emphatically press play. I like all these people.
Nick's going to like it.
Uh-huh.
I
would love to come back to you next year when this comes out and be like, you know what? I was wrong about The Fall Guy. It's a lot of fun. I don't think that's likely to happen.
I don't think this is going to be for you.
I don't think it's going to be for me.
Bye.
I don't know if it's more or less likely to be for me than Lyft, the Netflix movie. Now, Netflix has the benefit. It is F. Gary Gray.
I will make a premonition that you're going to press play on this.
I will. I will watch this. I will try it.
Which one is this one?
This is the one that the heist thing, that we got to take the plane.
Oh, right.
So this is F. Gary Gray, who did Fate of the Furious.
And Italian Job.
And The Italian Job, which are two really good heist movies.
Yes.
I love a heist movie.
Yeah, heist movies are great.
The cast includes Vincent D'Onofrio, Kevin Hart. Who else?
A few other notable people. Let me look
it
up.
They have to. They're criminals. They get recruited by. It's not Tessa Thompson, is it?
No, it's
Mbatha-Raw.
Yeah, Mbatha-Raw.
Okay. Ravonna Renslayer.
Yes,
Ravonna Renslayer.
They're going to heist a plane.
They have to heist a plane
that has like a gold
bullion or something that's been stolen, and they have to steal it back.
Right, it's going to go to terrorists if they don't heist
it. And they have to heist it.
And there's probably some reason why they have to heist it in midair and not, like, heist it anywhere else.
Yes, there's a reason. Who knows?
And so they begin concocting a plan to heist it.
Yes. This one is, like, I could go either way on this.
It has Sam Worthington, Jean Renault.
Okay, all right. So,
what's Jean Renault been in that's been good in the last 30 years?
The Professional?
That's, I think, over 30 years ago? It was, like, early 90s. 94. We might be right at the 30-year mark. 94. That's why I was trying to.
He was one of the bad guys in Mission Impossible, right?
He was.
Okay.
Okay. That was still the 90s.
He was in Godzilla.
All right, let's call it the last 20 years, then.
Not a lot.
Not a lot, yeah.
Anyway.
He was in the Da Vinci Code.
And Sam Worthington is just in dumb White House Down
movies, Sam Worthington's not. I always mix him up and think it's Sam Dancington.
Oh, yeah, one of them is...
Sam Dancington?
Sam Dancington.
One of them is Avatar, right?
Yes.
He's Avatar.
Sam Worthington is Avatar. Sam Rockwell is good in things.
Yes, Sam Rockwell. Sam Rockwell's great in things.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, he was Avatar, man. And Clash of the Titans.
Sam Worthington is not a good actor.
Right, he's actually a danger.
If you put him in there, that's a red flag. Anyway, Netflix has made some dumb but entertaining movies. They made that movie with The Rock and Ryan Reynolds and Gal Gadot.
Red Notice.
Which is very watchable and terrible. But I will watch the sequel when it comes on. That one I really enjoyed, even though it is terrible. And then they made movies with the Russos and Captain America and... I don't know, who was the other guy in the Gray Man?
Chris Evans and Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling. About two assassins or something. I don't know. And it should have been... I mean, this is the team that made made Winter Soldier.
They're also getting a pretty damn big movie this Friday, The Killer.
Yeah.
By Fincher. No, that's Fincher, but that's
okay.
Netflix.
Okay.
Netflix produced
it. My point is, The Gray Man was... It had the writers, the directors, and the star of Winter Soldier.
A very good movie.
One of the worst action movies I have ever seen.
I'm going to say that the Russos may not be the best directors in all the land because of Citadel and a few other things that they've done. And Chris Evans, he needs to find a better agent because picking
Chris
some
Evans
really
has picked,
shit.
Like three or four bad projects in a row. What I'm saying, though, is Netflix on occasion will hit the dumb but fun for me. Yeah. But it's like some executive there has his thumb on the dumb button and is just leaving it there because most of their movies are real terrible.
But a lot of people press play on them, and that's why they keep making them.
I know. But I think it's very unlikely I'm going to like Lift. I do think it's more like Lift than Fall Guy.
Airplane heists sound fun.
I think it's more likely.
You know what,
like,
this movie made me want to revisit the awesome movie Executive Decision.
Yes, which is great.
Which has some stakes to it.
But not a heist, it's an action movie.
That's true.
I feel like they didn't.
But it's like action suspense.
Yeah, didn't I hear that they didn't tell Steven Seagal he was going to die in the movie, and when he got pissed off?
Knowing how big his ego is, I don't think he would have agreed to it otherwise. No, which makes makes the movie extra. It gets an extra star.
Yeah.
for humiliating.
Yes.
Him.
Yeah. Anything you do with Steven Seagal,
Colonel Austin Travis, I believe, was his ridiculous name in that movie.
That's so good.
But it is actually like a legit, like, good movie.
I've rewatched it in years, but I would rewatch it.
It's good stuff.
Oliver Platt.
Anyway, I might like Fall Guy. I might like Lift. I'm definitely not going to like Lisa Frankenstein.
Right. All right, so we're on to our next movie.
Yep.
This is a very poppy-looking movie from the writer of Jennifer's Body, and I think vibing similarly.
Yeah.
This
looks
a little
Heathers,
more...
but wished it was dumber.
You know, I was going to say, this looks I'm not even a big fan of Heathers.
But you're definitely not going to like this.
Yeah, this is Lisa Frankenstein.
A girl brings back a Frankenstein boyfriend.
Yeah, it's like a new take on the Frankenstein mythos. Yeah.
It has quippy dialogue.
That's
the Ablicotti's thing.
Yep.
Now, that was a quick counterpoint to this. I joked that this was warm. What was it? Warm Bodies.
Warm Jennifer's Body.
Warm Jennifer's Bodies. Yes.
Warm Bodies is great.
Warm Bodies is a zombie romantic comedy kind of thing. And yet is extremely clever and kind of fun. I don't want to oversell. It's not an amazing movie, but
it's fantastic.
It is incredibly watchable.
It's the best zombie rom com I've ever seen.
It is the king of zombie rom coms.
Actually, though. I guess it's not because Anna of the Apocalypse is better.
That's probably true, although...
And if you want to qualify Shaun of the Dead as a zombie rom-com, it's the best.
It's not really a rom-com.
Okay, fair enough.
Just to the point, like, there's a version of this, I think, that I could like.
Same.
But this one, the jokes, I kind of felt like the quips and stuff weren't really landing strongly.
Yeah.
I feel like Diablo Cody's particular brand of quippiness might be of an era.
Yeah.
In the same way, I think probably... were Joss Whedon doing more things right now, I think we would find that to be the case.
Yeah.
Or, like, you got to kind of push forward a little, move forward a little more. Yeah. Nick.
I wish Joss Whedon's only problem was that his dialogue had gotten problematic.
Yeah.
I so wish that was his only problem.
I will probably watch this. Diablo Cody has made... So, Jennifer's Body, what else has she written? Did she write Juno? Which I do like Juno.
I don't think Juno ages well.
What was the TV show she did about the nurse with, or somebody with multiple personalities? Not nurse, but...
United States of Terra.
Yeah.
I was messing up with Nurse Jackie. I never watched that.
Me neither. Tony Collette.
I remember one time I somehow, like, watched the first episode or two, and weirdly, I found it pretty watchable. Like, it may have actually been the best Diablo Cody thing I've seen.
There's a television show you've seen that Nick and I have never seen an episode of?
What was it?
I mean, just an episode or two of it.
What was it?
What was
United States of Terror?
Oh yeah, no, I've never seen it.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
Yeah, she has. You know, I was over at my brother's and his wife was watching it, I was just like, I don't know. Somehow it worked out that I ended up watching it, and I was like, you know what? Surprisingly good.
Okay.
So I'll leave some room for possibilities there, but not on this one. This looks like ass.
Wow, I don't think I could say that it looks like ass. I would probably watch it. Yeah, I really like Catherine Newton, who plays the lead. She is from Freaky and Quantumania.
I like her.
Said the billing cast, I didn't see her in it, but Carla Gugino is in it.
Damn it, Nick. Not fair.
I don't know. Diablo Cody is not my most favorite, but I think I like her stuff more than you guys do.
Yes.
I believe it actively kind of makes me kind of a little cringy.
Yeah, I definitely not into Diablo Cody fan. I was for a little while, not anymore.
Did you ever see the movie Young Adult with Charlize Theron?
Nope.
That she wrote?
Nope.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
All right, let's talk about the worst trailer we watched for probably was the worst movie here.
Okay.
I think we might agree on this one.
Family Plan.
This is awful.
Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
Many problems with Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
Is doing his own riff on True Lies, where he used to be a covert assassin.
And he's a family man now.
He's a family man. He's got a wife and two kids and a baby. A very active baby.
Yeah.
Yep.
See, the baby, like, makes little goo-goo-ga-ga quips throughout the whole thing.
And poops.
And I guess midway through, I'm like, if this doesn't wrap with some baby poop joke, then what are we even here for?
And, yep.
And guess what it wrapped with?
Yep.
Guess what it wrapped with?
It's a nice big punctuation mark.
And, yeah, basically...
they have to flee...
He gets
burned or whatever.
He's Michelle Monaghan and his wife, long-suffering Michelle Monaghan, who deserves better here.
Yep.
She's done nothing wrong in her life except
she chose
this. She is, like, wishing for a more spontaneous husband because her boring husband is boring. And then he comes home and he's like, we're going on a family trip to Vegas, spontaneous, and it's all great. And then assassins start tracking them down, and baby starts cooing at them. And he has to reveal to them that he's an assassin, and he has to be an assassin one last time.
Right, and, like, what if he was at the supermarket with a little baby carrier on, and he had to fight
and
a dude?
Fought a guy.
And it's all played very,
Jason,
like...
Statham did this so much better in Fast and the Furious.
John Cusack did this better in Gross Point Blank.
Yeah.
He didn't have a baby, did he?
No, but he had the random fight a guy in 7-Eleven.
Yeah, that was...
The Jason Statham thing is also, like... It's like a sequence in a bigger movie, but it's not like the whole movie.
45-minute...
Yeah.
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 This is another one where also, like, none of the jokes were landing.
None of the jokes land.
The action didn't look good. The
action didn't really
And also, good. Again, they trap Michelle Monaghan in this, and that loses them points.
They didn't trap her. They paid her.
No, they did. They dragged her in. I don't know how. Yep. Maybe it was but the money is still a trap. They made her do this.
If they told me that Mark Wahlberg should just do like a random big hit sequel or that's the only thing I will allow him to do anymore.
Big hit two.
Is a trashy big hit sequel.
What was the last thing Mark Wahlberg did that was good?
Italian Job.
Yeah, Italian Job.
Well, just 40 years ago, probably.
40 years ago.
When was he... Oh, no, that was another Wahlberg.
You're not
in,
saying that Transformers, whatever iteration he was in, was good?
Not. Nope.
I did watch that Netflix one where it was an adaptation of, like, a crime book. That was bad.
No. I mean, I guess some people liked him in The Departed.
Spencer for Hire.
Oh, you know what? I actually thought he did a pretty good job in The Departed.
Maybe The Departed is his last good thing. Which, I don't know when that was, but it was not recent. Anyway, this looks terrible.
No, it doesn't look good.
But we'd like to try and warn you off of it.
So if you have Apple TV, by God, don't watch this.
Apple TV is very hit and miss. They do some really great things.
Yep.
And then they're like, we're just going to produce this thing that has Mark Wahlberg in it, and it looks like shit.
The same people did Ted Lasso and what so many other
Killers of the Flower Moon?
No, those are on the same level. Very different, but same level.
But, I mean...
Cherry, another Russo Brothers special with Tom Holland that was also awful.
I didn't subject myself to that. I did not press play. Pressed play.
I did, and I regret it deeply. I've learned a lesson, Nick, that you still have not, which is that good people can be in really bad things.
Yeah. No, I know that lesson. I don't care.
Just choose Nick will enjoy the performance
at
times.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. The treat I promised at the end is there's a new Planet of the Apes, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
These trailers are always good. These movies have always been good. Dave, I know you have a fondness for the originals that Nick and I have
I think the new ones are pretty well made, but I'm not, like, super drawn to them, I guess. Yeah. Like, I didn't feel, like, a real need to have seen the third one.
You're like, too many apes, not enough planet?
weirdly, there's something about the weird alchemy of the early ones, and... Something interesting about those original ones is, like, how tightly connected they are.
Right.
Even to the point of, like, they sort of mirror comics in that they also have, like, a few continuity issues.
Right.
But they were definitely trying to connect them all up, and they went to weird places, and they're like, oh, they killed everybody on Earth in this one. And, like, you would just be like, what?
Yeah.
That's really what they're doing?
Yeah.
So, I do have a fondness for the originals, but it was a late-earned one. I didn't grow up with it. You're
like, mole people, or we riot?
I watched them when they did the bad Tim Burton one, and they re-released them all at the
Speaking
same time.
Mark Wahlberg.
We all had a certain fondness for that terrible movie, I think.
It has a certain fondness.
I don't think it was like the movie, but there's some very striking striking moments in it.
You gotta give it up for Michael Clark Duncan.
Bow your heads.
Bow your heads.
And Tim Roth.
Tim Roth. But you know who the star of that is? Is Paul Giamatti.
Yep.
As the slaver ape.
Yep.
Who's meant to be kind of lovable.
The slaver ape.
Okay, like, so, what a weirdo you are, Tim Burton.
So I had to see the synopsis, even though I'm going to see this movie because I thought the trailer was good. I like these movies. But it says, many years after the reign of Caesar, a young ape goes on a journey that will lead him to question everything he's been taught about the past and make choices that will define a future for the apes and humans alike. That's a solid premise. Yeah.
Have they had Cornelius in this mix?
I don't think so.
I wonder if that could be him, because so there was this imagery in it that resembled the original Planet of the Apes movie.
Yeah.
Apes riding horses and, like, yeah, capturing humans.
Human barbarians. Yeah,
yeah, humans who had kind of fallen into a barbaric state where they might not be able to speak anymore. It looked kind of like the original one, but, you know, with instead of dudes in costumes, it looked like the cool CG apes.
Yep.
And I was like, well, the heroes in that are Cornelius and his wife.
I think you're thinking in the right direction. I think that's what they're going to probably do.
That's pretty cool.
At some point, they've got to be thinking, we've earned enough credibility, we can actually do sort of a remake instead of just a prequel series.
Right.
And we can do sort of like homage to the original original movies.
Well, the way the original one worked was, Charlton Heston or whatever, what is it? Did they do a new actor? I forget, but like, basically, the future got nuked. It did get blown up, but Cornelius and like his wife Zira, I think they went back in time to like the 1960s, because of course,
yep,
you always go back in time to whenever the movie was made, and then you saw the events unfold that would eventually lead cyclically back to the plague and stuff like that, and the thing that would lead to the future Planet of the Apes future, and instead they just began in the present with the current ones. And instead have led up to it, seemingly.
The director of this is a guy named Wes Ball, who's not the one who did the previous trilogy. He did another trilogy, though, The Maze Runner, which I think is kind of an underappreciated YA trilogy movie.
Yeah, trilogy.
It's easy to
that
make.
Dumb joke is always going to make us laugh.
It is.
Yeah, fiction.
But it's a good series and good production value.
Okay.
But I was looking up his IMDb, which so many movies are attached to different people.
Yep.
But the other movie he's tapped to direct right now is Mouse Guard, which I didn't know that was a thing.
Oh, I mean, it's still in development. So
yeah.
That guy is not happy unless he's making a movie with CG creatures.
That's true.
Pretty good trailer.
The trailer's good, yeah.
Like a lot of them, it's you know, cool imagery and moments, and it's kind of hard to tell exactly what the story is, but looks solid.
My question is, will they at some point do the human astronauts come from the past into the classic Planet of the Apes story, or does that not fit into this continuity?
I think you could.
Because this almost feels like the one, like, they've almost eliminated, like, this is all at human characters up to this point. Usually it's like human resistance fighting against the apes taking over. But this looks like basically this is an apes only story.
Well, yeah, I think there's humans.
Well, there's barbaric humans, but I don't know if there's gonna be like a human central character.
I don't know.
It would be interesting if they like find somebody, teach him to speak, and then find out this guy is like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot everything, but I've been on this planet for like 20 years and I was an astronaut, and you find his ship and stuff, and you're like, oh shit, it's Charlton Heston. He devolved into barbarism.
And also he's alive again.
And also he's coming for your guns.
That would be a hell of a twist if Charlton Heston is alive and revealed at the end of a Planet of the Apes movie.
Randy, the CG is pretty good.
Are you saying they're going to weaken to Bernie-ism?
Yes, I say you weaken to Bernie-ism and have him as like a ridiculously anti-gun guy.
Yeah.
He's like,
we've
got to get the apes away from the gun, the guns away from him, and destroy them all. Peace is the way.
Look, people don't talk about this, but it's actually okay to take Charlton Heston's guns now.
That's true.
He told you that it's okay.
Except for the ones he's buried with.
He said,
no, they're in his cold dead hands.
You can have them, I'm sure.
Those are the ones you have to take.
Right, but then he like warned you there could be prying involved.
Yeah.
I don't think that would reanimate his corpse.
You can't steal the ones out of his house, because that was never specified. You can take the ones he has in his grave in his cold dead hands.
Maybe that was just a test, and then once you do it, you reanimate the body.
When you when you take the Gunsmith's Cold Dead Hands, there's a map on there, the secret constitution.
Right. He's like, I really wasn't that into the whole gun thing. I just wanted people to go on a fun adventure after I died.
I think we've cracked it.
This is clearly the case.
All right, let's take a break that we clearly need because our brains are boiling in this room, and then we're going to get back and talk about some topics. All right, we got a few things to talk about left. Nick, you have dived into the world of Gen V,
the
boys spinoff at Prime.
Correct.
And I have said, I'm on record, there are 8 episodes, I just finished it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe this is even better than The Boys, which I really have enjoyed.
I think I might need to see it as a whole to judge, but right now I think The Boys is a little bit better.
Hmm. I was under the impression that like the initial thought was like, The Boys didn't need a spinoff. Do y'all agree with that?
But
what I heard from
it
people.
Didn't need one.
Yeah, but then Eric Kripke really was like, one. "Oh yeah, I let's have some more fun."
So okay. this is set at Godolkin University,
right?
Which is God U because everything in the Boys universe is a marketing campaign by Vaught Industries.
Yep. This takes place after the season 3.
Yeah, it's right. It's contemporary with The Boys. And these are the kids who are, they get superpowered kids, they go to this college, and they are trained in either the superpower the superhero division, or the much larger entertainment division.
Correct.
These kids are often, they come from broken homes.
Their kids basically gave them an experimental,
Their
parents gave them an experimental thing as babies.
They gave them superpowers.
Usually that resulted in a bad thing.
Yeah.
Usually the loss of life of their parents.
Yes.
Because something bad, happened when their powers manifested.
So it is a mix of these, like, kids who grew up in a foster system just desperate for love.
Yep.
And then all of these people telling them how amazing and special they are, and he results in a bunch of narcissistic monsters.
Uh-huh.
There's worse going on, too.
There's worse going on.
Because it turns out the school isn't just about educating supers for the next round of the 7,
right.
Their big super team, but also there might be someone trying to wipe them all out or imprison them or something
or experiment.
Else. Yes,
or experiment. And it opens with their titular character named Golden Boy.
Yep.
Going a little crazy.
A little crazy and murdering the head of the school.
Yep. Played by...
Clancy Brown.
Clancy Brown.
Clancy Brown is great as head of the school.
Yes,
I gotta
say,
Clancy Brown's a good person to murder off.
Yeah, yeah. And he is sinister. He deserves his murder. But Gen V does a good job, the Boys does too, of like, neither side is right.
No.
They're all a little wrong.
Yeah.
It's funny, Gen V does the same thing Invincible does, but I don't always like it in Invincible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because in Invincible, everything is still super. Like, everybody has weird superhero names. People call themselves things like Invincible and
Bullet. Right, it has the kind of fun, more innocent tropes of superhero stuff, and then suddenly a dude's head explodes.
Yeah,
right.
Whereas in Gen V and The Boys, all of the superhero stuff is artifice. It is made by corporations to play off of what people like about superheroes.
Exactly. And then there's the shock, because this stuff, like The Boys, there's some crazy stuff that happens.
and the powers are all weird. This reminds me a little bit of Wild Cards. Like, all the powers are weird.
Yeah.
So, like, the girl who shrinks, she shrinks by vomiting up. She has to binge
purges.
Purge.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
She has to purge in order to get her body weight out. And if she wants to get back to normal size, she has to eat all the way back up.
Or she can eat more.
And she discovers that she can eat more to get giant. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, is this a series that can be watched by somebody who hasn't seen The Boys?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, it stands well enough on its own?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just finished watching the Tech Knight episode.
Oh man,
Jesus Christ!
Tech Knight's like their
Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes, but also like the reality. what's the show? Undiscovered Mysteries or
Unsolved Mysteries?
He's like an Unsolved Mysteries guy, but he's a sleazebag.
Oh, it's by 1,000%, he's a sleazebag.
And
but like everybody's kind of a sleazebag in their own.
Also,
right.
Not to give too much away, but Tech Knight has a thing for trees.
He has a thing for holes.
Holes.
It's not trees.
But
just
sometimes the holes are in trees.
Do I need to leave this podcast right now?
I'm just saying.
Scaring me
it's
exactly what you think.
I'm familiar with The Boys' weirdness.
It's juvenile humor that like doesn't work for me on a comic book page.
It doesn't work in the comics for me either, but Eric Kripke, for whatever reason, has managed to make it work.
He finds that little like twist to it, and I'm like, okay, that's funny.
I think part of it is all his characters are very interesting. Even the ones who are like sociopaths, like Homelander, the guy they play on Homelander, he's great.
He is
playing an absolute monster, and yet he humanizes him just enough where I'm like, I want to see this guy's what he's thinking right now.
Well, the main character that we find in this show is a woman who does blood. Like, she has blood powers.
Yeah.
She can control blood. Yeah. And that.
And she discovered them when she accidentally murdered her father and her mother in front of her sister.
After getting her first period.
Yes. Period, yes.
It was that was a hard scene.
I'm just shaking my head at the depravity.
Yeah,
Dave, this might not be for you.
No, I mean, like, actually, within that context, that sounds to me like I would take this in a heartbeat over Invincible for the same reason Randy...
Yeah, I think you would actually enjoy this.
But, I don't know. I'm four episodes in. There was a big cliffhanger on episode four. You said eight total?
There's some real mind-twisty stuff in the middle of it that I'm sure you just hit, I think.
Yeah. Well, and then just like some of the other characters have, like you said, all have interesting abilities.
And there's some big reveals about, wait, I thought that was the bad guy. Wait, who did this? And yeah there's it's really good. It's really well written, and they are doing what I call the Mike Schur school of, well, just tell the story, and we'll find more story later.
Yeah,
like they're not holding back. They're moving forward on stuff.
Yeah, they definitely like their cliffhangers, and yeah. They're just kind of like, let's get through this. Let's move.
An 8-episode network is. Or 8-episode show is perfect, and it worked really well for me.
Yeah.
Nick, almost as long as watching all 8 episodes of Gen V, is the movie you went to see in the theaters.
I did. I made the mistake of having several drinks at the Draft House, and I barely made it through it.
Oh my god. Killers of the Flower Moon, which you might have heard about if you're a fan of Martin Scorsese, or a fan of the Marvel movies who has heard Martin Scorsese in every interview talking shit about the Marvel movies because people think it's hilarious to ask him about it for some reason.
I just stop asking him.
Stop asking.
You know the answer. He's an
80-year-old man. It is not for him.
Or, y'all Marvel people could grow a thicker skin.
Why ask him? Who cares?
But if you're asking Martin Scorsese, ask Greta Gerwig. Ask all the other people.
Yeah.
Don't just ask the creepy
maybe
old man.
Nobody who's involved with Marvel. They just asked one of the guy from The Bear. He went in for a Marvel, he's a Marvel-y edition, and he was like, why should I be in your movie? And they were like, fuck you. And he's like, fair enough. So like, he was like, yeah, it's not for me. And I'm like, you know what? Also, why did you ask him, why does everyone have to be in a Marvel movie, man? It's not for everyone. Yeah. Anyways.
Now that we've talked about Marvel, let's talk about this movie.
I will go on record as stating that I'm not the biggest Scorsese fan.
You were never even big into, like, Goodfellas.
Yep. No. I mean, I've watched it a couple of times. I see what people like about it. He kind of revels in the sleaze in a lot of his movies.
He does. You are, like, arguably it's non-judgmental, but it is meant to, like, a case could be made that he's still glorifying that stuff.
A little bit.
Because he wants to put you in the shoes of people who are really enjoying very amoral lives, or immoral lives.
And that is definitely like Taxi Driver, Casino, Goodfellas. This one, I mean, I read the book that this is based off of, which is obviously nonfiction.
This is a historical occurrence.
Yes, occurrence. 100 years ago, the Osage Indian tribe basically struck. They were pushed onto a plot of land, thinking it as a punishment, and then they struck oil and became the richest society. Right. Sort of not. I mean, not unlike of Tulsa, the Black Wall Street kind of that kind of stuff.
If you had to guess how the powers that be reacted to them suddenly being on wealthy land, what would you guess that they did? Did they just say, you know what? Good for them. This is a nice little bit of boon for them.
No, the white
men. That's not what happened, is it?
No, the white men decided, how can we get that money? Mm-hmm. And do we need to kill anybody? And the answer was, yeah. A lot of people, actually. The movie does an interesting twist in that the book was kind of it was structured as kind of a whodunit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The movie just, in the first couple of minutes, outright tells you who the bad guy is. It focuses a little more on relationships and it centers.
There's a format that can work. I always remember that was the nature of Alan Moore's From Hell.
Yeah.
Is to immediately reveal who he thought Jack the Ripper was, because he's not telling a mystery. He's interested in what, you know, the why of it, which for him was a mystical thing. When they made a movie of it, though, they turned it into a more traditional whodunit.
Right. Scorsese, this movie has apparently went through, like, a heavy rewrite during a portion of time. Mm-hmm. Leonardo DiCaprio, who plays one of the leads in it was going to play basically the cop that sort of solves this, and then he decided he wanted to play kind of like, not a, he's a villain, but he's not, he's a sympathetic villain in some aspects, because he's kind of...
He
not,
falls in love or something with one of the native...
He marries. Yeah. He marries a woman named Molly Burkett.
I remember when I was watching the trailer, I was like, oh, they show that he's going to be sympathetic to their cause and stuff like that, and then, but like, I believe he still ends up being
well,
a bad
Robert
person.
De Niro is basically the major bad guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, spoilers. Tells you in the first few minutes, but
yep.
He is doing everything he can to get as much money from the tribe as he can, while also pretending to befriend them. But Robert De Niro does a really good job of playing a sleazeball. And
it's interesting to see when I sometimes his roles have been like kind of a bit broad lately. Like, and I was like, oh, I don't know, you know, he's been in a lot of comedies and stuff too.
Yeah.
I was like, can he go back and reconnect to the edgier old one? And the trailer says it kind of looked like he did. Like he kind of had some a pretty intense vibe.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, my wife turned to me and I was like, and she was like, I'd forgotten. Kind of weirded me out a little bit to see Robert De Niro. I associate him with Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers. And I'm like, yeah, if you do that, it is definitely kind of odd. But yeah, he's the villain. And you're sort of told the story.
Once upon a time, he was Cape Fear.
Yeah, of Leonardo DiCaprio, who is a military vet coming home to his uncle, Robert De Niro. And he sort of gets inserted into this area where this tribe is done, and they're trying to fleece them. Mm-hmm. And he actually falls in love with one of them. So the love story between those two characters is actually really well done.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad. Because, like, the fear of what Robert De Niro kind of holds over him definitely kind of shapes his life. And
mm-hmm.
DiCaprio does a good performance. The character he's playing is kind of dim.
Yeah.
He's not, like, he's kind of stupid, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. Nick, is there enough story here for the 3-hour-plus runtime?
Yes. It's one of those things where I'm glad this exists because mm-hmm. it might get to people who don't know this story.
Well, you know, we talked about this before when we watched the Watchmen thing.
Yeah.
We did not know about the... what do they call that now?
The Tulsa Black...
The Tulsa Massacre.
Tulsa Massacre. Yeah. Yeah.
But I believe it used to be, like, kind of more commonly referred to as, like, the Tulsa Race Riot. And which made it sound like, sort of like, oh, black people went crazy over something. Like, you just, like... A massacre.
Or we weren't taught it.
It didn't come up at all.
No, I mean, I don't remember ever hearing about it during, you know, whatever, high school, blah.
Right.
I mean, but I'm glad...
But that movie, that show got it out there in the public discourse again. It sounds like you were saying, Nick, this would be something that would be good to...
I think this is
people to know about.
Yes, however, I will say that you should watch this at home and liberally use the pause button if you need to pee.
Yeah.
And I know that is against Martin Scorsese. He was like, you do not need to stop this movie. You should watch it all. And I'm like, dude, I'm 43 years old. I need to pee.
You're 80. How do you not know that you don't do that to people?
I think he's a... but you know, this is not the first 3-hour movie ever made.
No.
And I mean, I think he's, you know, he's about that cinematic experience and everything.
And it is very cinematic. I mean, his cinematographer does an amazing job. He's worked with these people for countless years. The music in this, which is usually, there's a few very kind of at the beginning, very, not pop, but very robust kind of like loud music.
Mm-hmm.
But then it moves to sort of the somberness for like basically the last 3/4 of the mm-hmm. movie. And the music is just really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's worked with that, that guy multiple times.
I used to be a bigger Scorsese. I think one of the first Scorsese movies, maybe the first Scorsese movie I saw was Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Which hit me just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a result, I was like, oh, I'm a Scorsese fan. And then, you know, I later saw Wolf of Wall Street.
I have a hard time going back to Wolf of Wall Street.
I rewatched it. It's very watchable. It's just got... The subject matter is so problematic.
Yeah. My wife was watching it the other day because she was just wanting to zone out to something. And I was like, this is very...
They're all awful. Yeah.
I guess I wouldn't say it's problematic. I think it is. It's depicting terrible people. But the movie itself isn't.
But the movie isn't about how they get punished. It's really not.
Yeah, but it's not. He's doing actually the same thing he did within Goodfellas, which is showing, oh, in a way, like, it makes me kind of hate these kind of people more. I'm like, wow, they had a great time being utter shits.
Yeah, Dave, but that's because you are a more sophisticated film viewer. I think, as an overall thing, what he's doing is some of these guys, a lot of these Wall Street guys, love Wolf of Wall Street.
Right, right.
And I think the guys probably love Goodfellas.
Because they view the surface.
Yeah.
And, right. And that's
it's
the
like
problem.
One of those, like, I don't know that, like, you can't control for dumb, so you try and, you know, make movies for people who are hopefully a little smarter.
Yeah. I will also say that Jesse Plemons shows up as a main character towards the middle of it.
Okay.
I love Jesse Plemons.
Yep.
He is referred to as the poor man's Matt Damon.
Pretty much always good, Jesse
But yeah, no, he's great.
I've also heard him referred to as the poor man's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
No, that's a good one.
What little I have seen him in, I've been like, this dude can act.
Yeah,
y'all need
great.
To stop trying to like say he's the poor man's anything.
I mean, think it's just a running gag at this point.
Being the poor man's Philip Seymour Hoffman is definitely not a...
If you told me that they cast him as Dusty in the new Twisters movie, I'd be okay with it.
He's the only acceptable answer, honestly. Dusty needs to be surprisingly good actor.
Honestly, I like Matt Damon, but if you tell me I get Jesse Plemons or Matt Damon, I'm taking Plemons 9 days out of a week.
Plemons is great.
9 days out of a 7 day week.
So
I agree.
I recommend this movie.
Sounds like your butt's checking caches.
My butt's
your
checking caches.
Mouth can't write.
I recommend this movie. I don't know if you need to race to the theaters to see it.
Well, I think the people who would know. They are movies. They're cineasts. Is that how you say that word?
Cinephiles?
I don't say that word.
But you know the word I'm talking about.
I do not. I'll have to look that one up.
It's like cinemaphiles. It would be another way of putting it.
Yeah.
And they've already gone. There are people who are in on Letterboxd app. They're studying RTF and all that stuff. And yeah, otherwise, yeah, no reason for people to just watch it at home.
It's going to show up on Apple. At some point, I would assume.
I found that I'm not the Scorsese fan I used to be. Even before he started Shrek took on my favorite Marvel movies. But
what's your favorite? Is it still Goodfellas?
It's still Goodfellas. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that's beat Goodfellas. And I realized I watched around more of his stuff. You know, I watched
Bull?
Raging Bull I've never seen. What was the one that's Mean Streets? Watch Mean Streets was okay. I think The Departed is okay, although not as good as Infernal Affairs it's based on.
Yeah, I don't
know.
To me, the two big ones are Taxi Driver and Goodfellas.
And I didn't love Taxi Driver. So I think I discovered that I'm just not a huge Scorsese fan in general either.
But I'm also not a huge Scorsese fan. Like,
And I watched the Gangs of New York.
Gangs of New York.
Which I actively hated.
I would say it's not a great movie because the original is great, but Cape Fear has some greatness in it.
Cape Fear is really good.
Some of the most intense stuff I've ever seen.
I'm going to throw out a weird dark horse.
Say Age of Innocence.
No, I really like Bringing Out the Dead.
Oh, you know, I haven't seen it and I always wanted to.
Nicolas Cage and Martin Scorsese together.
Tom Sizemore, I believe.
It's a weird movie. About an EMT and sort of the chaos that they ensue during it. It's kind of a bonkers movie, but I feel like that is more in
step with...
You know
it's not a mobster movie.
No, it's not. I mean, it also... It does feel like... That feels like if you told me Michael Mann directed, I'd be like, oh, that makes sense.
Also, I remember enjoying it a long time ago. I've never rewatched it. The Color of Money. I want to revisit.
I've heard that's good.
Because it's Paul Newman and Tom Cruise.
Sequel to The Hustler.
Yep.
He does not make a lot of sequel movies. Was that based on a book?
Yeah, I think it might have been. Okay. I mean... I will give credit to everybody's like Scorsese just making mob movies. He's absolutely made different movies.
Yeah, he has. But there was a good 10 years where that's what he was
making. He made some of the best mob movies. I mean, of course you go to your strengths, but yeah.
I also think I think he was adjacent to it growing up and was always fascinated with, so it's his thing.
The dude made a lot of good movies and he deserves to say whatever he wants to say about the MCU.
Sure.
But at the same time, I definitely have gotten to the point of like, well, and I watched The Irishman. I thought that was boring.
Yeah,
and I've kind of realized that for me, like he is someone I respect, but not necessarily like as a filmmaker. And that's kind of where. And so I don't know that I'll watch Killers of the Flower Moon, but it's interesting to hear it.
It's kind of where I was with Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah,
but like I really liked his last movie.
Yeah. I absolutely think something can come out that every time Scorsese does something, I'm going to take a look at it and see whether I want to see it.
Yeah.
Nick, on a very, very different note, what about you're so not invited to my bat mitzvah?
So this was us, my wife and I, searching for a lighthearted movie. And I remember on a whim that this was getting some good praise. This is an Adam Sandler project in most regards. The whole cast essentially is his family in a lot, for the most part, okay, except for Idina Menzel, who plays his wife in this.
That's from Uncle James.
But
Idina Menzel was his wife in Uncut Gems.
Was she?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I completely forgot about that. Yeah, no,
she's his wife.
Wow.
Yeah, so his daughters are actually his daughters in this. His wife plays the mother of one of his daughter's friends. But it is about sort of the Jewish heritage and the bar mitzvah mm-hmm. that they go through and sort of what it means nowadays to what it meant for an older generation, mm-hmm. sort of, and kind of how his daughters are kind of view it as more of a pop sensation of, like, I want to throw the largest party right. in like all the land. Like my super
sweet 16.
Yeah, and it'd be sort of, she is best friends with another girl. They've been friends since they were kids. And during high school, or during this time period, they have a falling out. Things go wrong, and it's sort of her figuring out herself in a lot of ways. I just thought, I mean, we've seen this kind of coming of age story a lot, but I thought this one was exceptionally well done. It was had a little bit more to say than I was expecting, and Sandler was kind of in the background, but he played.
So is this an Adam Sandler movie?
No. No, okay. It's definitely right. The daughter's movie.
At no point does he go like, get out of the party!
I mean, he definitely punctuates a few things uh-huh. with traditional Sandlerisms, but he is kind of like the good-natured dad in a lot of ways, just playing kind of an everyman.
Yeah.
He's not playing...
He's not playing one of his dumb guys.
No, he's not playing a water boy or anything like that. Yeah. He's playing kind of a Jewish guy who... doesn't quite understand his daughters.
There might be. Does he like to write, direct any of that stuff?
I don't know if he did. I don't know. I don't think he does. I think okay. he just produced it.
He's just an actor.
He's just an actor in it. Yeah, this is on Netflix. It's an easy press play. It's a very sweet movie, and I do recommend
okay.
it.
Scale right. of 1 to 5.
I think I gave it a 3.5.
Okay.
Yeah.
Solid 3.5. But not there. Just not upper tier.
No. Yeah. It's not the best, but sounds it's fair. Definitely worth watching.
And Dave, to close this out, you're going to talk about the vigil.
Yeah, this is a very different Jewish tradition, but steeped in an actual Jewish tradition.
Yep.
This is like an indie horror movie, mm-hmm. High on the creepy factor. Not a lot of jump scares, but not without them.
Yeah, it's definitely got a couple of good ones.
And what's kind of cool is it's not super predictable. You've got a guy who I don't know, Nick. Do they ever specify his trauma?
I don't think they did. I'm trying to remember, because he's basically...
He's like a 20... I'm going to say he's about 20, and he has a kind of an oddball vibe. It opens at this, like... It feels like it could be like a counseling session at, like, a rabbi's house with some other people who
yeah.
seem like they've undergone trauma. And I don't know if they ever say precisely what it was, but you know he's on some meds... And also that these meds can sometimes cause hallucinations and stuff
right.
like that. So there's a little bit of what will come afterwards that's a little suspect. And
he's also sort of down and out. He needs money.
Right.
And he gets hired to...
I forget what they call...
Is it Schomer?
He is the Schomer. I forget what the tradition is called. Which is like... It's kind of like... It's not quite the sitting Shiva thing. But it's a... When someone is like recently deceased, like they just died... And they will be taken away. This is, by the way, an Orthodox Jewish community.
Yes.
And
basically said vigil over the dead body to
like,
sort of...
Like that night or whatever until they are taken away the next day.
Correct.
For, you know, like for sort of a like an Orthodox treatment and burial and all mm-hmm. that. And the idea is sort of to, like, you know, pray over the body. And I think in sort of the... For spooky purposes, it's like you're meant to kind of protect the body from, like, you know, any spirits that might be... you know, I'm sure this is not how it is put in real tradition, but like protect it from bad spirits, basically.
Correct.
And he only takes it for the money. In fact, he doesn't want to do it, but somebody can pay him a couple $100,
right.
$200 or $300, and he needs the money. And so he's like, "Sure, I'll do it." And like, it's slightly complicated or like creepy complicated. It's like a smallish house with a it's an older guy who's died and his wife.
is like upstairs, like who's like secluded herself.
She's got like dementia or right. Alzheimer's or something, so some sort of mental decline.
I'm trying to remember the specifics.
Yeah, and so that makes things a little weird too, because her own cognitive functions, you know, you don't know if you can trust.
Yeah.
And she's kind of a little spooky. And but like as soon as he and there's like literally like a like cloth draped across a body. Laid across on a table, mm-hmm. I think, in the, like, living room.
Yep.
Again, kind of a small apartment, but a few rooms in a kitchen and an upstairs thing. And the movie essentially follows the night of him sitting Schomer.
Yep.
And he's, but, like, the first thing he does is, like, put on his headphones and, you know, stop paying attention to it. He's not going to pray over it. It's right. not his thing. You get the feeling he is not, like, he's not exactly super into the faith.
No.
He was, like, he seems like, but things will be revealed over time. Mysteries relating to the deceased.
Mm-hmm.
Mysteries related to his own kind of feelings of guilt and something that happened to him, an incident that that still kind of haunts him.
Yeah.
In the meantime, some very spooky stuff happens.
I remember the movie feeling very claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Just because it is set in a small house.
Well, he keeps on, like, just sitting there, and he'll, like, put his music on, and his back is to the body. Yeah. And if anybody who's watched a horror movie is just, like, waiting for it to move or something. And they don't tend to go with that a lot. But I will say there is a point where the body moves.
Yep.
There's
also a thing with a camera that was very...
Yes, I think I can sort of say, at one point he dozes off, right?
Yeah.
And he, check this out, Randy, he dozes off and mm-hmm. he wakes up like, it's like an hour's passed. And he's only got to like hold out till 6 in the morning or whatever, yep. and it's like 3 or something like that. And he's been like occasionally texting this girl, he's real awkward with women, but this girl was kind of like really showing an interest in him at the meeting. And so he's, like, texting her, and there's occasional moments where you're like, is he texting her, or is there some other weird entity or something that's impersonating her?
Hmm.
But later on, he gets, like, a video sent to him, and he, like, hits play on the video, and it's, like, a video of him just sitting in the room, filmed clearly while he was sleeping. And
it's creepy.
The person, whoever it was, like, holding the camera... like, gets closer and closer, so they're, like, right up against him, and, like, you see a hand come out and, like, brush his face and hair and stuff. It is a disturbing and unnerving yeah. scenario. Anyway, yeah, it's a pretty satisfying conclusion, mm-hmm. I think. And, again, this is, like, indie horror vibes, you know? This is not going to be your big jump scare kind of movie, but it's, again, not
kind of psychological horror.
Yeah, psychological horror is the genre overall.
It's really good. I definitely recommend.
Yeah I'd say worth checking out. What's it called? The Vigil.
Yeah. From, like, 2014, right?
Like, 2019.
Okay. We went looking for it, and you don't call it Vigil, because there's a lot of things called Vigil.
Right, you have to put The Vigil. And otherwise you'll pull up some other movies. There have been several movies just in, like, the last 2 or 3
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
And I believe this one, I think you want to look for 2019.
Yep.
But I think it, like, was, like, maybe released at different times, maybe in different places. So it could show up a year or two different from
yeah.
that.
Yeah. I remember going in Letterboxd and having yeah. fun. A little trouble
Good
finding
luck.
It. But I added it to my list.
Oh, the director of this actually did one of Guillermo del Toro's shorts from that Netflix.
Oh, that, okay. All right.
What is it, Cabinet of Curiosities?
Yeah. So that presumably yeah. means that del Toro was like, oh, I kind of like what this guy's doing.
Yeah.
That's it, I think.
All right. That'll wrap it up for us this week. And until next time,
Yo, Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.